Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Saw it on TV. I guess it'll be one empty seat when I wrestle at Wembley. I used to tear my shirt, but now you tore my heart. I knew you were a Hulkamaniac right from the very start.
Right from the start, you were my friend. I'll see.
Ringside to cheer me on tonight. The spotlight now grows dim, and now it's not on me. The prayers we said together are still our guarantee.
Hello, it is 34 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of May in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of this, the Emerson News Network, looming high above the milk packing district here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. Here's the thing about that song. I never really thought that I would have a chance to play that song in a way that was not purely ironic. One never really anticipates the various tributaries and turns that your life is going to take you down.
So there you go.
And yet, right. Completely sincere.
And I made at least one person tear up already. Well done. Aww. Thank you. That's Tony says, damn, dude, you're making me tear up at work.
Oh.
There you go.
Mission accomplished. That is counterbalanced by a listener named Brew Dude, who may in fact be Dan Bozek, who says, is it too soon?
Possibly, but then, you know.
How will we know, though?
Well, just tell everyone it's Dan Bozek and just let him take the heat for it.
That's right. There you go. Dan Bozek says, and I think we can all agree with this sentiment, says, It's time for Macho Man Randy Savage to snap into an afterlife. There you go.
See, that it's not too soon because I think Randy Savage would appreciate that.
That's how he says, "I'm not Dan Bozek. Don't tell anyone, sir." No, I think that's how the Macho Man would have wanted it. By the way, I found out that Greg Nibbler, by like an hour, beat me to the, oh no, joke. And I feel bad even saying that, but it was like that was the first thing. Sarah really hit it on the head, too. I came in and Sarah and Greg were in the kitchen. And it was, and there's that unspoken thing. I mean, I guess it's not really unspoken. It's initially unspoken and then spoken. So it's both. It's a thing that's two things at once. And it's here, yet it's there. Anyway, I came in and Greg just... I walked in and Greg said, "Macho Man." And I said, "Yeah." And then we just had a moment of silence. And then I said, "Is it too soon for the... Oh, no!" And Greg said, "No, no, no. I made that joke like an hour ago." And then Sarah noted that such is the... As Art Bell would say... such is the quickening of our culture that now you see the news and then immediately you're trying to outsnark the rest of the world on Twitter. You're trying to like set a land speed record for coming up with an amusing hashtag for the death of somebody. But I saw that news literally 17 seconds after the news first broke because that is when I saw the thing on CNN and it was like CNN says breaking news. Macho Man, wrestler Macho Man Randy Savage killed a car accident, and it was like posted 17 seconds ago. And in my head, I'm like, 1, 2, 3, oh no! And then immediately, but apparently, that was not fast enough. So, you have to get up pretty early in the day to outhash the rest of the Inertron.
Well, this is one of those rare cases, though, whenever people say, "Where were you when you heard a certain person died?"
You'll know.
I never know. I never remember. I never have any idea. Today, I can say. I heard this happened when I was face down on a massage table with acupuncture needles stuck in my back.
How is that possible?
I was getting stuff done to me this morning, and Andrew left the room.
Checking your Twitter feed? Or
no, Andrew left the room to go do something, and he came back. He walked back in the room.
Came back a shaken man.
He goes, "Oh, macho man Randy Savage." I'm like, got my face down the chair. I go, "Oh, that's terrible.
It's too bad.
Oh, I feel terrible about that."
All right. All right. Well, we'll talk more about that here in just a. I won't say that it's ruining my day or whatever. But I will say that I am legitimately brought down by that.
Yeah.
That is because I we'll talk more about this. This really, as much as we say this every Friday, this really is a place where Big Jim Willie. This is where he lives. Yeah. He's going to suit up to play today for the death of the Macho Man. It's probably inaccurate to say that I am a longtime wrestling fan, but I was a wrestling fan for a long time. And of course he was, and he was right there at the confluence of that whole, the rise of Vince McMahon and the rock wrestling connection and the whole, the MTV and the creation of and then ascendance of WrestleMania. So anyway, so we'll talk more about that here in just a bit. But more about me, more importantly, is I bit my tongue about 10 minutes ago. Right as we were.
Oh no.
Too soon. Too soon. Harpy. Why do you have to step on everything I love, Don? Anyway, but just now between the Legion of News hour and then this show, I walked to get myself a Vizo, and then I thought while I'm there, I might as well have get my snack on. So I just bought a smallish pastry.
Because you did run away.
Yeah.
At one point.
Well, because I realized I didn't have any caffeine, and then nobody wants to be around.
Did you go through that entire case of Vizo already?
No, I took it home.
Oh, all right.
I thought I'm not going to leave that here.
Okay.
A bunch of jackals in this building. No, ma'am. That's not staying. No. Those go home when I go home from now on. But as a result, I left the house this morning in a kind of an under-caffeinated state, and so the result was because I was under-caffeinated, I did not actually have the foresight to bring caffeine with me. And I didn't have time to make coffee or whatever, so I just thought, I'll go and get one. And so I got a small pastry, but then the instant karma for my gluttony was that I was, "Oh, this pastry's really great." Crunk. And then I just took, and it wasn't like I bit the tip of my tongue. Usually it's where your incisors or sometimes your canine or pokey teeth, they'll just, you catch the front of your tongue. This was really, it was like the molars, the grinders on my side, just caught like a huge section of the side of my tongue.
I do that. That is the way I most often bite my tongue. That and I will sometimes bite the inside of my mouth.
Yeah.
Where you bite down and you can hear it, you can actually hear it in your head go crunch
that
as
was
you
my,
bite into your mouth.
That was really my thing, is I
horrible.
Yeah, It wasn't so much a Slim Jim that I snapped into as it was my own tongue. And then, yeah, the sound of actually like, as you're kind of, and you're going, oh, no, that's going to hurt.
Yeah. And then it swells up just a little bit and you keep biting it for a while.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, and it's like, and when you bite it initially, you don't, it doesn't hurt a lot. It hurts just enough to give you a window into what it's going to feel like later on. Yeah. So now I got the whole like swollen tongue thing going on. And then you feel like you got to talk real carefully because otherwise you're just going to, or eating anything. Yeah. You're just going to be chomping on yourself throughout the day. So.
Yes.
So welcome to my afternoon. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. If you'd like to get on board today telephonically, you can do that. It's 503-505-6964. That is 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can also be reached. It's don@rickemerson.com. dawn@rickemerson.com. Or what, Don?
Show Pony.
That's right.
@rickemerson.com.
It's all one word. Show Pony @rickemerson.com. Text box open on the website, and you can Skype as well if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show via Skype. That is Rick Emerson Show. Let's see. By the way, this is not the. It apparently was not Dan Bozek. It was Eric, the guy who won a year of the show.
Oh, okay.
So there you go. And, then he says, yay me. There you go. Yay. Yay you indeed, sir. Let's see. Coming up today, we got Mr. Big Jim Willie. He's going to be in the studio here in just a short while. We'll do another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Also, Cannibal Watch coming up today. Penis Watch coming up today. Of course, Snuff Watch. And then Don Taylor tracking the following headlines for you on this Friday.
TMZ's Harvey Levin talks about Schwarzenegger's love child. Cheney's daughter says her dad's memoirs will have strong views. And a guy shoots himself while trying to kill a turkey.
Excellent. Fantastic. All right. I held off on asking about this last hour. Why don't you have your computer in front of you? You just got it like a day and a half ago. You were all excited about it.
Well, yeah. Here's where we get like a little, we got a window into your morning. We'll have a window into Dawn's world. First thing, went home last night, was going to get the Polidori Chocolates website up and running. The person I needed to deal with at my hosting facility was not available and said, well, call in the morning and we'll get all this to. I mean, okay, well, I'll call in the morning. So then I realized, I said, oh, God, I've got an appointment to see Andrew to get a massage and stuff tomorrow morning. Well, I'll get up early. I'll take care of I'll do my news. Then I'll make the phone call and I'll do all the stuff. So then I sleep in just a little bit and I get up at like 8. I've got to leave at 9 for the appointment, but I've got like an hour to do my show prep and to make that phone call. Get online. Comcast, for some reason, is not working. So then I call Comcast. And Comcast is going, oh, well, we've discontinued your service because you didn't pay your bill. And I said, well, actually...
Like you put it in a snarky tone.
And I said, well, actually, I did pay my bill. And she goes, oh, well, just a moment, please. In that, like, I don't believe you. And then she goes, oh, yes, you did pay your bill. Oh, well, I'll restore that right now. And I'm like, well, thank you. So then I get off the phone with them. And of course, restore that right now for Comcast means that an hour later when I left, it still wasn't on.
Well, of course.
So I had that thing where I'm looking at Patrick, and now I'm just getting more and more stressed because I'm going, okay, I can either blow off Andrew, which I'd already changed my appointment with him once already this week, and it's like in an hour, in like less than an hour. And then, or I can like go to the appointment and then just have a really limited window for getting my show prep done. Crap. And I still have to deal with this person about the domain registration and the server site. And so basically ended up making the decision that I would take my phone and do a certain amount of show prep on my phone, leave the laptop with Patrick. He could deal with the domain registration and calling the server people and doing that, even though he has no idea what he's doing. But I figured if he was all alone in the house and I didn't have to look at him, he might not be so flustered and he'd just do it. So that was what was it. So left him the laptop so he could stay home, do that, and listen to the show at home because he's home today because it's his birthday.
And happy birthday.
That's his birthday present. He gets to listen to me talk. And I would take the phone and do the show part because Mama needed her massage.
Okay.
I'm sorry. It had to happen.
So now we've figured out, but in the face-off between which is more important to you, your massage or computer technology, it is, in fact, the massage.
Yes. Now, this is the second time I've gone to see him, and we have decided that... yes, Don has decided this is a good thing.
If I may ask this, now are you paying for the massage, or is this out of the goodness of a listener's heart?
I will probably pay him at some point in the future, but right now we are doing it. It's sort of one of those, I will talk about him on the air.
It's just Plugola.
Yeah, it's just Plugola.
Okay.
That's it, purely it. And I'm going to have him on the show. I was just talking to Jim about this. Not this week, but next week, the following week on Ham-Fisted Radio, I'm going to have him in, and he's going to do acupuncture on Jim Willig on the air.
So it's not going to be Ham-Fisted Radio so much as it's going to be Magic Fingered Radio.
Right. Okay. And Jim's never had acupuncture, so it'll be delightful.
Okay. I'm guessing that Jim... What are your predictions on Jim Willig in terms of his back hair or his non-facial body hair?
I'm sure there's probably he was like, I'm in, and then I explained it would involve taking his shirt off, and he's like, oh no.
Are you thinking it's a substantial amount, like on the scale of 1 to 10?
He looks like he might be quite a hairy. I did find it because I got the acupuncture, and Andrew was putting some things down, like on my calves. And so I said, oh, I guess I should have, shaved my legs. And he goes, I don't know why women always say that, why they, worry about that. And I said, I guess it's true. You probably deal with a lot of, big, hairy men. And he said, and I guess there's not a lot of, HIPAA laws and confidentiality where massage therapy is concerned. Because he goes, oh, yeah, you should see how much hair Walker leaves behind on the sheet when he's done.
I could have done without that. Right, thanks.
Apparently, David Walker, a hirsute man.
Thanks so much. All right, reason 75 why, no disrespect to Andrew, why I will not be getting a massage from him.
And so. I got the cupping thing, which we had talked about. You've had the cupping.
I'm sorry?
The cupping, the little glass
cups. Oh, with the flame
in the
little goldfish bowl. No, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah, where they put a small domed glass bowl over you, and then they light a flame, and then when it goes out, it creates a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of move it around, and it's kind of a pleasing, suctiony sort of a feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was great because I'm just a mass of knots, and it hurt, but at the same time, it felt awesome. And I could tell it was, and it's just, and I'm all loose and opened up today. So.
It's weird that you were apologizing for not shaving your legs. Like you were thinking that, it's just an odd thing to apologize for, because unless you were going there thinking, well, a massage and then maybe a little humping, just as an aperitif, or something.
Well, I'm not expecting to, hump it out with my gynecologist either, but if I'm going to take my pants off and she's going to be looking, I always think maybe I should shave my legs.
Really?
Yeah.
Just because you wish to be aesthetically pleasing for the gynecologist.
Yeah.
Well, fair enough.
I have this thing about being... I think it comes from being a fat girl. I want as few things to be gross about me as possible. I want to make sure I smell good, that I'm well-groomed, that no one is exposed to, things that are hairy that might, offend them in any way.
All right, fair enough. I mean, I guess that's preferable to the other method, which is just sort of the turning into the skid approach of just, I'm not even going to bathe. And just, putting your hair in a ponytail and wearing wearing an Eeyore shirt for the rest of your life.
And I used to apologize to Patrick about it, and he'd just go, I don't care. So as long as he didn't care, then I figured, woohoo, score. I don't have to care either.
You would apologize for what?
For not having shaved
the legs.
Oh, it's not even not occasionally. It's that I wear pants all the time. I don't shave my legs. And I'm not a particularly hairy person, so it's not like it's a really huge issue. I'm not like one of those freaky, hippie, furry nature girls or anything. I have very little actual body hair.
Now, what about the underarms?
I don't shave those either, but again, I'm not very hairy. There's not a whole lot going on under there.
How much hair would you have? If I were to, not that I'm asking you to do this, but if I were to look at your underarm area, are we talking about quarter inch?
Well, I mean, it's long-ish, but it's not very thick. Yeah, there's not much there.
Is it long enough that you could braid it?
Very poorly. And also, it's not really thick enough that you'd be able to get enough. There's really not much there, really.
I'm just curious about it.
Anyway, I think about those things.
Oh, yeah. No, me too. Well, let's see who this might be. Hello, hi, you're on the Rick Emerson radio program. Sir, madam, as the case may be. How can I help you?
Hey, Rick and Don, how are you guys doing?
Hello, hi, hey.
This is House Husband Dave over here in Camas.
Hello, House Husband Dave.
Woohoo! I'm sitting here folding laundry, listening to the show from yesterday, and I hear Dawn tell that she's going to be living under a bridge pretty soon, but she's going to go home and start up this chocolate business website, and I should order chocolate right away. There's no chocolate website. It don't work.
Well, we were just talking about this. It will be functional quite soon. I just got all of my domain registration issues and my server stuff squared away. So this afternoon, I am going home. Everything is going back live. And so by this evening, everything will be ready to roll.
Okay. You know, well, I don't want you living under a bridge. And,
well, thank you.
I figured if you really didn't want to live under a bridge, you would make that happen.
Well, thank you. I don't want to live under a bridge.
So he's endeavoring to give you his money and simply lacked the mechanism by which to do it. So really, I mean, if that doesn't itself demonstrate the exceptional nature of the audience, that he's actually calling it, taking time out of his busy day and his busy morning, calling in and I'm not even complaining, but just sort of noting the fact that he was unable to give you his money. So
I wanted to give him money.
When you say your house husband Dave, now is that like a thing you rotate? Are you a single dad, or do you rotate that with your wife, or is it just like an off day for you?
No, it's a permanent fixture for the last 8 years or so.
As it now, but are you single, or do you have a spouse or a partner who works?
I have a sugar mama.
I'm sorry.
He has a sugar mama.
I have a sugar mama.
Good for you. Well done, sir. And I mean that sincerely. Because let me just tell you this. Because we left KUFO at the end of 2009, and everybody else immediately was like, "I'm starting a podcast. I'm doing an online thing. And I was like, "F that. I'm staying home." And so from I guess November of 2009, which is I think when we got fired. So like December, January, February, March, April, May, June. So for almost 7 months. I was exactly that. It was, we don't have kids, which makes it a little bit easier. But my wife would go off, and she would bring home the bacon, as they say. And I was at home, and I was Mr. Cooking, cleaning, tidying up. And I got to tell you, I'm not saying that the housewives have it easy, or especially like stay-at-home moms have it easy, because that is a difficult job, and it's a thing that only later did I gain appreciation for in terms of my own mother. But I got to tell you, that was really a glorious 7 months. I think all things being equal, if this had not come back together, I think I would have been satisfied to do that for quite a long stretch of time. I found it was sort of zen, actually. I found it actually kind of a centering, sort of calming 7 month period of my life. So I don't cast any sort of judgment on that, sir. So congratulations. If you can get, look, and here's the thing. You can land yourself some hot babe who also makes, a fair amount of money. God bless you. You do that thing. Be that guy. I strongly encourage everyone to do that.
Secure my manhood. It's a good life.
No, really, it is. I mean, there's no... People are like, "Well, don't you care?" And I'm like, care? No. I mean, really, what am I going to... Because the alternative is for me to have to go off and get, a job of my own. And I mean, who wants to do that, really? I mean, if you don't have to. So if there's money not only coming into the home, but the money is, being brought into the home by a woman who then, Fs you... I mean, really, what better confluence of circumstances could you possibly find? The answer is none. So, excellent. So you are listening to yesterday's program. Just because I'm curious about these sorts of things, do you typically listen a day behind, and do you get it via iTunes, or how do you get the show?
Usually a day or two behind, and yes, iTunes is how I listen to it on my glorious iPhone.
Excellent. All right. I'm almost curious about how people are... whenever somebody calls in, we do sort of a one-person focus group just to see how people are listening. Excellent. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. And keep an eye on Don's website. That'll be up at some point in the very near future. But thank you for the support, sir.
Absolutely. Always happy to give you my money.
All right. Thank you. There you go. That is...
Have a good night.
You as well, sir. That's house husband Dave. All right. There we go.
House husband Dave.
Right, fantastic. Let's see. Somebody say, "Dear God, are we having body hair talk?" Well, not now, but that's only because we were interrupted by Dave. I think it's more or less, it's in an end, I would say, at this point. All right. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It is 1:55 on Friday. That is May 20th, 2000. And by the way, speaking of being house husband and house husband Dave and Rick, I'll get to this in a second. Before I talk about this, I got to ask you, because several people have queried me about this and I didn't have the answer. So what was the... I mean, to whatever extent there can be some sort of a definitive outcome to the whole discussion about Fahrenheit 451 and the derivation of the quote.
Well, we talked about it and we kind of came... I think ultimately it came down to, for Bobby, Court and Bobby have made the statement at Geek Trivia that the correct answer to any question is the answer we have decided it is. So that in and of itself meant that
That's the thing you don't want to tell geeks, though, because say that to geeks, because geeks will spot any crack, any flaw, any hole anywhere in any answer.
Yeah, and Bobby's take on it was that the story itself is about burning books. So therefore, Fahrenheit 451 is the temperature at which books burn, compounded by the fact that that was a tagline on a couple of editions of the book. And we also, but we also acknowledged the whole Bradbury quote, where he said that it's the temperature at which
book paper
burns. So therefore, everyone is right and no one is right all at the same time.
It's awesome. It's the perfect outcome, yeah. Really. Speaking of being a house husband, I don't know, this isn't really that interesting of a story, but I will say that so my wife has been out of town for the last week or so. She's been in the glorious bosom of Mormonhood. She's been in Provo. And so she, because there was like all of this crap that's like that she has collected over the, or that her parents have collected over the years, and like little bits of furniture that she had sort of like staked a claim on many years back, that it's, you know, and her parents are both still alive, but you know, where she was like, you know, one of these days I'd like to have this chair. And so all the stuff was just like going into her parents' garage, and along with a few other things that were just, you know, like the stuff that she had growing up or whatever. And so she's been putting this off and putting it off and putting it off for years. And so she finally last week rented a truck, drove all the way to Provo in a truck that was like the size of Kansas, by the way. I got to post a picture of it. You can no longer rent a truck.
Couldn't rent one there and just drive it one way?
Well, but how would she get there?
You'd fly.
Well, but that's going to be, I mean, that's going to cost like way more, though. Oh, like okay. A one-way ticket. You know, like a one-way ticket to something, like a round-trip ticket, actually, I mean, proportionally speaking, is much, okay. You know, is much cheaper. Yeah, one-way ticket, because then you're going to have to go, then you have to, like, you know, get the, and plus, when you get there, you're not going to know if you, you know, you don't, if they necessarily have the truck or whatever. Anyway, yeah, so she rented a truck here, and then drove all the way to Provo, gathered up all her crap in Provo, by the way, which includes two matching chairs, which I may bring in and put in the studio to replace these sort of hodgepodgey chairs that we've got in the back. They're solidly built American chairs, Don, in which we can be comfortably ensconced.
Nice.
So she brought all the stuff back, but you know, but as a result, she was gone for like 4 or 5 days, and then I told her very, very clearly, very, very carefully, and I repeated it to her several times, and I made her repeat it back to me. I said, because she's coming back with a friend of hers. Her friend Michelle came back with her and is going to be here for a few days. They're going to go to the coast or whatever, and then her friend's going to go back home. But so, her, you know, she's coming back into town after 5 days with a friend, and I said, for the love of God, like, you got to tell me, give me, like, 2 hours notice because you're driving. Like, tell me when you are 2 hours away. And she said, why? And I said, well, you know why, so I can clean the house, because it's just going to be a cesspool. And I said, so you've got to give me at least 2 hours notice. And she said, okay. And I said, swear to God you'll give me 2 hours notice. And she said, I swear to God. And I said, okay, you'll give me how many hours notice? She said, two. And I said, great. Why? Because you got to clean the house. Yes, it takes how long? 2 hours. So you're going to give me 2 hours notice. And so, of course, as everybody now can see coming, so she calls me last night and says they're like 45 minutes away. And so then I'm just like doing this like whirling dervish through the house, just trying to, you know, just trying to clean up. And that's just, you know, and it was like this whole comedy of errors because she wasn't around, like a whole bunch of other stuff. Like, the things just piled up in the house. And then also, I think I forgot to take out the trash on Sunday. So the trash hasn't been emptied. So then I'm like bagging up a bunch of refuse and trying to sneak it into the neighbor's dumpster when nobody's noticing, because it's not all going to fit in the trash cans in front of our house. And then I realized, there's no real point to this story, but to say that if you had been looking in the window of my house last night, which is easier than you might imagine, you would have seen me with about 25 minutes left before my wife arrived back home with her friend, removing the former toilet seat in our bathroom and then trying to install a brand new toilet seat, which apparently is a thing that she had told me to do and had left a note on the toilet seat to that effect. But the toilet seat had become this sort of like Easter Island statue where I didn't want to see it, and so therefore I didn't. And I think I just walked by it in the hallway like 1,000 times. And you don't really ever realize how little skill you possess in some sort of like in a mechanical sense until you have to put on a toilet seat and the clock is ticking down from like 14 minutes. And then you further realize that because your wife is the one who does all the household repairs, you have no idea where any of the tools are kept. And you can just, you know, read into this whatever symbolism ye may. But my wife has all the tools and she keeps them locked up somewhere and I don't know where they are. And so then it's like I'm just doing that thing of like taking a butter knife to the toilet seat. And then, like, once I get the old toilet seat off and I manage to get the new toilet seat put on, which of course, you know, then requires... And it's not like I'm all grossed out by the idea of cleaning the bathroom or whatever, but then it's like you're laying on your back underneath the toilet, and it's just, you know, and it's just...
Yeah, and then you go, oh, there's stuff down here.
And then
here.
You're just like, you know, well, you're like, well, this is just... I'm in Buttville down here. I mean, it's just like, yeah. You know, and it's just there's a funk down there that just doesn't, you know... I don't even mean like butt funk. I mean just like...
No.
Just it's sort of that mildew kind of a smell.
Yeah, everything has been moist.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, and plus it's like, how long do you really want to spend down there cleaning when you do clean? Not that often. So, you know, you're doing sort of a cursory job at best. But then, so it's like, then I get the new toilet seat put on, more or less without incident. But then I have this old toilet seat, and it's previously established our trash cans are full. And so now I am at, like, in broad daylight, lugging an old toilet, like an old... I mean, I must have looked homeless.
Oh, you didn't just put it behind the refrigerator?
Well, no. That's... that because here's the thing about putting the pizza boxes behind the refrigerator. If you do that, I mean, you know, what's the worst that can happen? The refrigerator gets a little warm, the pizza boxes catch on fire, the house burns down. You know, I mean, I guess that's the worst that could happen, but that's probably not going to happen. But I mean, you know, at least, but that in a way is at least, that in a way would almost be better than what would happen if you put the toilet seat behind the fridge, which is then the butt funk just fills the entire house. And then the friend walks in from Utah and says, hints of toilet, you know, because then the entire place just smells like an old ass toilet seat. So I must have just looked homeless or crazy or some combination of both. Because I was just walking around the block yesterday, just trying to find a dumpster where nobody was sort of... And the thing is, it's not like doing it at night. I mean, we've all done the thing of, like, dumping trash in a neighbor's, you know, dumpster or in a neighbor's, you know, trash can or whatever. But you do that after dark. And you kind of, you know, you do the Hogan's Heroes thing. If you put on a knit cap and, you know, a stocking over your face, and you creep over and you open the dumpster and you dump all your crap in, and then you scuttle away like a crayfish. But during the day, you can't do that, especially because yesterday was really nice and it's really warm outside, and so everybody's kind of just hanging around, everybody's standing outside, and so the first thing I do is I walk out of the front porch, and I've got the toilet seat under my arm, because there's like it's not like I can put it under my shirt. There's no way to disguise it, and there's nothing you can hide it in.
No.
Like it's not gonna fit inside, you know, like a plastic bag from Safeway or something. So I walk out of the house and I take a left and I go down the sidewalk and I stop at this this house, and there's a big dumpster out front. And of course I'm walking along with a toilet seat, and so of course everybody's gonna look at me because hey, guy walking along with a toilet seat. And I pause just long enough that, by definition, they have noticed me walking by and stopping. So now I just can't go walking into the parking lot and just be dumping a toilet seat into the dumpster because they would see it. And I mean, then you're
so
the guy.
So now you just have to keep walking
as if you're
on your way somewhere.
As if I am taking the toilet seat on a stroll with me. As though I'm one of those guys with a bruised tailbone that has to carry like a inflatable donut around that I got to sit on.
You're like that guy with his giant Hello Kitty, except yours is a toilet seat.
I was like Steve Martin in The Jerk. I was just sort of lugging, and this toilet seat, and just walking to, and I must have gone like 3-4, and every time it was the same thing, I would stop and I go, here's a dumpster. At one point there's a guy on my block, and he has these big, big trash cans. They're not the recycle bins. I mean, they're regular trash cans, but I think he must have bought them custom. They're huge. And he's behind a gate most of the time, but the gate was open. And I actually did toy with sort of like just running onto his property and just like stashing the toilet seat in the trash and then running away. But then I noticed that his wife was standing in the window looking at me because I was standing. And of course, you would too.
Yeah.
Because there's a guy standing on the sidewalk staring at your house clutching a toilet seat. I mean, why... What explanation? You might eventually come to the realization that I was taking the thing around from place to place looking to dump it, but that would probably be after a while. I mean, I think you'd spend a good amount of time wondering if you should call the man.
Well, and in Southeast Portland, you just see things like that, and you just go, oh, there's a guy holding a toilet seat.
Another guy lugging a toilet seat around the neighborhood. And, yeah, so I stood there for a while, and I went, well, no. So if you'd had a Google map of the whole thing, you would have just seen me shuffling from place to place. I forget where
You're like Billy with the little dotted line going all around the neighborhood.
Exactly.
with your toilet seat.
And I finally had to go, like, down a block and, like, over a block and a half to be able to find a place where, I didn't think I was going to be spotted, and B, even if I was spotted, I wasn't known. And so they wouldn't be able to, oh, it's that Emerson boy, dumping a toilet seat in our dumpster, you know, and I was finally able to get rid of it. But I mean, this is just, you know, it's just a thing you don't, it's a way that you do not necessarily anticipate spending, a chunk of your afternoon.
No, it's like when I told you that story before about how we had the extra mattress, the old crappy mattress we had to get rid of, but you can't just take mattresses.
Right.
To the dumpster area at the apartment complex, and there was always, so we ended up just like taking tin snips and shears and cutting it down into smaller pieces so we could carry it out a bit at a time to the dumpster.
It is the thing that, like, if I'd had another day or two before Laura got home, if I'd remembered, in other words, to, you know, when she left me a big note on the toilet saying please install, if I hadn't just immediately blocked that out with some sort of like mental Firefox add-on, I might have actually done it a day or two earlier so I could put the old toilet seat out on the curb just to see as an experiment. I kind of wish that I'd done this now.
If someone
would take it.
Yeah.
You know? Because I've learned that the key to getting rid of things in my neighborhood, by the way, is not to say free. It's to say $1, and then someone will just steal it. If you say free, then they go, well, what's wrong with it? I mean, in this case, it's a toilet seat that has had, like, other acid all over it, for 10 years. But, I mean, if you said, like, a dollar, and somebody goes, well, there's nobody here, free toilet seat. And then they, and then they take it. I mean, I would be curious to see if that would have worked. So, you know. All right. And see, and somebody's noting I could have put the old toilet seat in the box that the new one came in and then put it out, and that would have made it look like I just had a new toilet seat. But, put it out for trash in that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, but then you're still a guy with a toilet seat just sitting on the, in front of your house. And it's like, you don't want to be that guy. And plus, that's not the thing that my wife's friend would have, oh, welcome to our lovely home, which we have decorated with a series of bathroom fixtures, out front. So, anyway, so when you asked it, how I spent my evening, that was how I spent my evening. Is scrubbing and then walking around the neighborhood with a toilet seat. The end. All right, we'll do this. We'll come back on the other side with Mr. Big Jim Willig. We've got another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 coming up. Today we'll talk about, actually speaking of the jerk, Mr. Steve Martin. That is on the way, plus Cannibal Watch, Penis Watch, and a Snuff Watch. So stay there. The Rick Emerson Show continues after this. Go nowhere, ladies and germs.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
could do it all over again. Well, I'm going to the liquor store. I'm going to buy you a really big bottle. Girlie, won't you pour some light into my life?
Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Just a moment, we'll be joined by Mr. Big Jim Willie in the studio for another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. So we'll get to that in just a second. Today we're going to be talking about the life, legacy, and career of Mr. Steve Martin. So that is on the way. Plus, we got a snuff watch coming up. Also, a penis watch, cannibal watch, and all that. Don't forget, this coming Sunday on AMC, another installment of The Killing. So I think we're going to be in episode number 9 this coming Sunday. That is episode 9 of the first season of The Killing this Sunday on AMC. It's funny, I actually got an email from somebody yesterday, a woman who said that, I don't know the actual upshot of this, I don't know the resolution, I don't know whether she did or not, but she said that she was actually trying to convince her husband to postpone their vacation because she didn't want to miss, I guess they were going to be gone for like 5 days, and she was trying to convince him to leave on Monday, not Sunday, because she didn't want to miss The Killing. So it really is, it is quite an exceptional show. So that is Sunday, and then we'll do our recap. We really will do our recap Monday. That's not a thing that we're going to, not another thing that we'll dangle in front of you before cruelly snatching it away.
Hey, I don't really feel that way much about TV shows, but I like my Lost fixation was pretty heavy. And I can't remember what night of the week Lost was on, but we were out of town. We were visiting Patrick's mother. And I remember at some point just going, we have to get back to the hotel by 8 o'clock. I have to watch Lost.
I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday. It might have been Wednesday, but I think it was Tuesday because Wednesday I would have to sit. I mean, I understand that, you know, people who liked Lost really liked Lost. But I would have to sit in the studio while Sarah and Chris Paddock just sat there and nerded themselves into a frenzy going, well, but then he opened the door and the goat was there and he was in San Francisco for no reason. I don't understand, you know, which is like listening to someone else describe Lost is like listening to someone else describe playing World of Warcraft. I mean... can I just tell you, I was reading, I know this makes me sound like a tool, but I was reading this longish World of Warcraft article this morning and realized I don't play World of Warcraft. I've never played World, which not that there's anything wrong with playing World of Warcraft, and I'm not saying that I'm better than people who do, but I'm just saying I find the culture of and the phenomenon of World of Warcraft really, really interesting, way more so than I find role-playing games themselves. Like, I find role-playing game culture and online role-playing game culture really, really interesting. And I've read, I've read a couple, the MIT of all places actually put out this fascinating book a couple of years ago using World of Warcraft as a sort of, as a way to examine societal constructs about various things. So I will read those articles a lot, but there was some guy who wrote a really, really long, in-depth article about how, like, World of Warcraft Cataclysm had apparently done something. It had altered the in-game dynamic, something to do with, like, when you're going on, like, a, I don't know, when you're going on like a supply raid or something, or when you're doing something that involves a whole lot of other people. But it was like, I realized at a certain point, I'm going to see if I can dig up the article. It seems like at a certain point, reading about World of Warcraft, it becomes like when you're reading the bridge column in the Oregonian, where it's all like, you know, trick the dummy to the left-hand spade, to the club, east, you know, east, diamonds. And you're just like reading, going like, I don't understand any of this. And so that is what listening to people describe Lost was like. If you didn't know what Lost was, if you didn't know it was a show, if you didn't know that it was a show that fundamentally was, you know, playing with the constructs of time and space, it just sounds like gibberish. I mean, hearing people describe Lost, if you don't watch it, is like when I used to go visit Lara at this place. She used to work at an Alzheimer's clinic. And you would go in, and the thing about Alzheimer's patients that's really awesome is that, at least for certain people in certain stages of dementia, they don't talk like they have dementia. In other words, their inflection, the confidence, the mannerisms with which they deliver their sentences are totally normal. It's just that the stuff coming out doesn't make any sense at all. And it would be a whole lot of like, so then I went with the purple crayon to the celery to the can opener, and then I was on top of the roof because then the eagle was there along with Neil Armstrong, and then we were about the bottom of the ocean, and then there was a submarine. And you're just kind of going, okay, great. And then they would nod, and they would kind of, you know, chuck in the shoulder and walk away. And you, like, they had no idea what they just said was just this confluence of words that made no sense whatsoever. That's what it's like listening to people talking about Lost. Why was that just talking about Lost?
Because we're talking about the woman who didn't want to miss the killing on her vacation.
That's right. By the way, apparently Lost was on Tuesday and then Wednesday.
Okay.
So it transitioned at one point. Hey, speaking of shows, well, let's do this before we do anything else. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program, Mr. Big Jim Willick. Hello, sir.
Skinny way.
Whoa, sorry.
Skinny way, sway in the wind, chicka-day-day. You're just talking about gibberish and dementia.
Okay, I didn't know if you were referencing something.
Nell with Jodie Foster, Liam Neeson.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
No.
Wow.
Okay. You're going to find that Nell references are kind of lost.
What? Come on. Nell is the new hotness. I don't know. You're talking about World of Warcraft? Okay, I guess I'm the nerd then. Okay. Evs.
All I know about, I think my sum total, I think all my knowledge on Nell comes from out of context sound bites that the Donna Mike show would play, which was just a lot of like, you know, or whatever. And that's it. That's all. Are those moments in the movie?
Yeah, there's a lot where,
yeah,
I mean,
it. That's all I've got.
For those of you who aren't as Nell savvy as apparently I am, it's a lovely tale of a woman who was raised pretty much in the wolves, pretty much raised in the woods by her grandmother, who then dies, and then she kind of like grows up mostly on her own and learns to speak this kind of like gibberish language. So that's
This is
and she's topless in it. Jodie Foster topless. So if any of you guys out there ever wanted to see that,
Mr. Skint could tell you exactly
3 hours, 4 minutes, 21 seconds.
What the time check is on? Yeah.
Now, see, you say that like you say that like I won't do it at some point. Like one of these days, I'm just gonna have him standing by, and then I'm just gonna uncork him. Hello, Big Jim Willick. How are you?
Hello. How are you? I'm fine, actually.
So we were just talking about something during the break, and you started to say something, and then we immediately stopped. We said, no, you got to save that. Wait till we're back on the air. So When we last checked in with you, Mr. Big Jim Willig, you were getting ready to do. So you were going to be doing. Initially, you had been set to perform at an Applebee's to bring your comedy to the good people of the. Are they the place that has the onion thing, or is that Tony?
That's
Ramos?
I think it's Outback with the Bloomin' Onion.
Yeah,
yeah, that's.
They also have an onion thing at Chili's, I think, as well.
Ooh, yeah.
What is the trademark dish at Applebee's? Would you say? Do they have a?
I don't really know if they have like a Big Mac or something like along those lines. It's pretty much. I think they have like the riblets. Where it's basically much just like, you know, like.
What are riblets? It just sounds like, disgusting.
What? It's basically boneless, like rib chunks in nugget type shape.
Okay, see, that actually sounds great. See, yeah. The idea of boneless, but riblets just sounds.
Yeah. Something that comes in a can that like homeless people eat and fight over.
And because it sounds like, I know it's supposed to sound like niblets, but it sounds like giblets.
Yeah.
And so it just sounds like that big bag of throat or whatever it is they when you buy your turkey.
Pretty much anything with.
Bag of throat.
Well, what else is it? Isn't that what it is? Isn't it just like neck and lungs or something in that bag?
What are we having for dinner tonight? Rick Emerson's big bag of lung bits.
Yeah. I don't even know what's in that bag.
Well, no,
I'm going to start referring to that as the throat bag, by the way, from now on.
Well, here's a question before we get back out of the Applebee's thing. What are giblets exactly? Is it a specific thing or is it a catch-all term that doesn't mean anything in particular? Anyway.
I think it's an actual part of the chicken or turkey or pretty much any kind of like land-based fowl that you can pretty much you take out of the animal to eat, but can also use as like a stock or a base to make other delicious bits of holiday food.
Then what is a gizzard?
The gizzard isn't the gizzard the thing that helps the chicken break down the hard grains. It helps.
Oh, so it's like an appendix.
Gizzard the thing that has the they eat rocks and the rocks are in the gizzard and helps break everything up?
The internal rock tumbler.
No, I think you're right about that. And that is like a second stomach that is actually that helps to mulch up things that are hard or tough.
I mean, the first person who found a chicken like, wow, there's nothing about this animal that I don't want to eat. Are you kidding me? Oh my god.
By the way, Applebee's. I just looked up Applebee's and just some of their specialties, and they have something. Most of the stuff actually sounds. You know, tasty enough, but they have something that they call a tango chicken sandwich, which is described as grilled and seasoned chicken breast topped with reduced fat cheese and barbecue ranch sauce. That sounds horrible.
It really doesn't sound like a thing. And I don't have, and it's not like I'm opposed to Applebee's. Again, it's like Applebee's is sort of like Red Robin, that it's one of those things that we're required to make fun of. But I don't, you know, but
no,
here's
everything
the thing.
Else sounds actually quite delicious.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever gone to an Applebee's and just said, like, this food is terrible. I mean, it's not tremendously adventurous food.
Get me a Nolens skillet.
If you are. Does it really say Nolens?
It says Nolens. See, right there. Nolens skillet.
That's authentic.
I prefer to have my food with an insulting black dialect.
Yes.
Food tastes a lot better when it's served in pigeon. Jesus.
They also have a super house sirloin. They have a regular house sirloin, and then they have a super house sirloin.
The super house sirloin actually landed in a meteorite in a small town and was raised by this elderly couple.
See, Jordy Verrill sirloin.
Okay, this stuff is making me hungry. I'm reading about meat, and I love meat.
By the way, just a little sample of what I'm talking about. So this is, let me just read to you just the tiniest bit of this World of Warcraft article, just so you can understand what impenetrable jargon this is. And so this is an article about the Cataclysm, which I think is an expansion pack for World of Warcraft. And I know a thing or two about expansion packs. I remember having furious debates with my friends about the Quake expansion packs, like way back in the Paleolithic era of gaming. So I know how these things can sometimes add to and sometimes detract from a game, but. This is, and I think this was on Dig this morning, which is how I eventually saw this. But this guy, let's see, this is written by Jeremy Conrad, and it's an article about the Cataclysm expansion pack for World of Warcraft. Let me just read a little bit of this here.
Thank you.
It's all for you.
Is it sad that as soon as that played, like my brain just instantly shifted gears?
He's complaining about how the fact that the upgrade means that you're getting a lot of noobs that are in that are not really up to the challenge that battles on Azeroth require. He has an introductory paragraph about the expansion pack, and he says, The result of this is heelers and tanks at the level cap without the slightest clue of how to deal with crowd control and pulls.
God.
This compounds onto itself by frustrating the healers and tanks so that they bail on groups even in the middle of boss pulls because it's too hard. I play an arcane mage, Frost, in PvP in WoW that's currently 85 and running heroics with full superior gear and an equipped average item level of 342. So naturally, I'm the one who needs to polymorph the trash.
Well, naturally.
What the hell does that mean?
Well, let's go to our correspondent, Shandor. Your thoughts on this whole thing.
I mean, listen to this. He gives an example. He says, here's an example of what I'm talking about. Heroic deadmines run with a tank marking trash for CC.
Durr.
He asks me to sheep the star, and I say, okay. He says, start. I sheep the mob and watch as the remaining mobs come and kill me. The tank didn't know that polymorph would pull the rest of the trash. I mean, what the hell, man?
Where's the booby doctor when you need him?
I mean, I know that does mean something. I mean, I'm not mocking as such. I'm just saying it's like it has just become like its own impenetrable culture in more ways than one.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why I find World of Warcraft so fascinating, is because there are these entire like imbroglios that sort of that are created and develop and then rage and then subside over time, and like the rest of the world never even hears about them.
Yeah.
I mean, there are probably like huge like culture-rending disputes that have happened in World of Warcraft that I have been oblivious to.
Friendships have been created and lost.
It's like how we talk about their television series now that go on the air, have a 7-season run, and go away, and you've never even heard of them.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever heard of Ace of Cakes until I inadvertently saw that like a marathon like a year or so ago. And I guess it had been on for like 3 years already. So it's just the strangest thing.
Done with AOC? All right.
The laptop I just got... I was looking, and they had the little HP section that they put in there. Said, would you like to try and play some games for free? And I said, sure, I'll play some games for free. So I played something. Would you like to buy it? No. And then I played something else for free. Would you like to buy it? No. And then there's that whole thing like, you could try World of Warcraft for free. And I'm just looking at it and going, no.
Yeah, see,
no,
but you're not...
I don't even want to start it, no.
Now, are you... Well, you probably are the kind that would end up playing a lot of... Like, you'd be one of those, like, Evercrack kind of people.
I have a couple of times been involved in these ongoing games that just keep going and going and going. I played this thing called Puzzle Pirates for a while, where you went online and you, like, were a pirate and you played these puzzle games, but you went on ships and you sailed ships and you had to keep doing the puzzles to keep the ship going. And then you made money and you bought a ship and people had stores. And I would go into like the thing. I ended up mostly just playing a lot of poker. And then, you know, then I had a ship. But then once I had a ship, I had to like invite people to come out and sail the ship. And of course, I had to join a crew so I could have like people to be on my ship. And it just became way too complicated. Then I start getting the emails from the guys going, you know, there's going to be a flotilla at like 3 a.m. on Tuesday. And everybody, and I'm like, I'm not showing up to play a game at 3 a.m. on Tuesday. Yeah, and so, you know, I just finally started going, you're making too many demands of me.
I think when we were at Wonder Northwest, I was over at the A Jumps B Shoots, which is a video game podcast, and they had an open mic set up, and they were just sort of, you know, having people come by and talk about, like, you know, the video game that they had been playing recently. And we got into this whole discussion of first-person shooters, and we were bonding over Doom 3, and the idea that Doom 3 was sort of a dividing line for all of us at the table at that point. It was Matt and his co-host, whose name I forget, and myself. But Doom 3 had been this dividing line for all of us, because Doom 3 was the point at which a first-person shooter where, you know, with Doom, it's all about atmosphere and it's all about, you know, the games are sort of fear-inducing and they're kind of creepy. But Doom 3 was the point at which the games became so terrifying that they were no longer enjoyable to play. It's like you spend all day at work, come home, and I'm going to relax now by playing, you know, and then it's like you're just getting a bunch of giant spiders with upside-down human faces charging at you from the darkness, and you think, this is not really the stress-relieving activity that I'm looking for right now. And so all of us, it turns out, had bailed on that game. Because it was just draining and it was no longer enjoyable. So it is with things like World of Warcraft, where it does. I know so many people who it just becomes like this second job.
Yeah.
Or I think Kristen Bowie was that way, where it was just like consuming massive amounts of her time.
It's not so much the second job; it becomes the primary, and your actual source of income becomes the thing you have to do in order to maintain your life inside the World of Warcraft. And it's ridiculous. Back in the day when the tabletops pretty much reigned supreme, and the internet wasn't quite as prevalent as it is now, you kind of had to walk around with your badge, and you know, you were openly mocked and picked on. But now you can just sort of sit in your dark, cool mom's basement with the bandwidth and just like relax and under the glow of your screen and live this lifestyle, you know, completely, you know, outside of the popular view. But since it's become such a massive thing, now those that aren't a part of it are becoming those that are mocked and picked on. And soon there'll be like this entire, like, in a real world slang and gangs and groups that sort of wander around with giant PVC weapons and whatnot, kind of living the SCA lifestyle everywhere. And if you're not a part of it, then you'll be like grouped up and put inside a wooden carriage and boarded into the center of town, and vegetables will be thrown at you. Come ride with me. Let us to the store and find Vizo and provisions that we may ride. Sorry, right. I just need to get that out. This Vizo is good.
Right. I'm actually surprised that doesn't happen more often. The idea of the real world of Warcraft folks sort of. Because you got to figure if there's like 6 million people or whatever, I guess it's more than that, it's like 12 million. Yeah. So it's like 12 million people who play it. If 1% of them are just flat out psychotic, I mean, it seems like, I don't know what 1% of 12 million is. It's a lot, though. And it seems like you would eventually get some sort of like a weird, you know, some like Mazes and Monsters meets the Warriors meets, you know, like SCA, where they would be like roaming the street with like plywood swords, you know, attempting to do battle with like everyone. If you've read that book, there's a book by a Portland author, and I forget her name at the moment. She wrote for Willamette Week in the Oregonian. She wrote a book called All God's Children, which was. A couple years ago, there was this girl who was she was beaten and set on fire down by the and beaten right down the street from KUFO actually.
Yep.
That the overpass right by that 7-Eleven at First and Arthur by this gang of street kids, this so-called street family. Yeah, yeah. Because one of the girls involved called Court on the air about it, and Court from Court and Bobby, he's actually mentioned in the book because one of the girls who was convicted of being a participant actually was. Unsurprisingly, big KUFO listener. And so she called when Court was doing nights back in like 2003 or 2004. She actually just called him up and they were having a conversation, you know, off the air, and he was rolling tape on it. And he was like, so where are you calling from? He's like, prison. And so they actually have a bit of an interview with Court in this book, which I didn't know until I read it, which is sort of great. But it was, yeah, this whole street family. And the guy who ran it, whose name was James something or other, they talk to at great length all the members of this street family, most of whom are incarcerated or were at the time of the book. And he had this sort of Dungeons and Dragons, and I'm not obviously not a thing where you're blaming Dungeons and Dragons, but he did view the world through this weird, like, I am the hero of my own epic thing. And he, you know, and he would do a thing of like, you know, taking on, and again, they're just gutter punks, but he would send them on these like reconnaissance missions throughout the city, you know, and so that they, and he would have them go forage and bring back items of great energy and strength giving potential to him. And he was clearly
like the Fisher King up in this piece.
Yeah, no, he clearly had like some very porous wall in his head between reality and not. But I am surprised.
Like a creaky screen door, more like it.
That there aren't more people who are really into World of Warcraft that don't like tip over mentally somehow and like bring that into the real world. So,
well, no, I mean, it's become as addictive as any drug. You know, it's something that it becomes all consuming. You know, everything takes a backseat. Hygiene, connection with others. You become detached. You forge these relationships with people that you've never physically met, but, you know, like have battled with and suffered with and leveled up with for years and years.
Lara, actually, when we were in Salt Lake, you always hear these stories, but she actually had a good friend, or a friend of hers named, we'll call her
Patty.
Whenever I go to, like, say, we'll call her, like, the only name I can ever come up with is the actual name for some reason. I don't know why. We'll call her Patty. But this is one of those things that you always, you know, you read about, like, in Dear Abby or something, or somebody passes a chain letter around. But she actually had a good friend of hers who ended up getting kicked out of her home. Her spouse kicked her out of the home, you know, and they had kids together. And it's, you know, but she ended up being booted out and ended up living in a car for a while and all this because she was, like, all on the EverQuest. thing and just and you know didn't go to work for long stretches of time to play EverQuest. And it's certainly like the exception, not the rule, but it was which was sort of a precursor, I think, to the World of Warcraft thing. And like literally just everything started to fall by the wayside because of it. And she did end up as that example, as the horror story you always hear about losing her job, losing her family, losing her house, everything because she was so fixated on it. Guy says, I went to school with a guy that got addicted to World of Warcraft so badly he got booted out of school, lost his scholarship. So it's just, you know, it is a, and I don't think there's a previous, like, I don't think earlier generations had any equivalent to this. I mean, there isn't really, there wasn't like an antecedent to this, like in, you know, the 50s or something.
Yeah, I had
a girl who worked with at a newspaper I worked at, and she came in. She started as an intern and then started working part time, and she started dating this guy. And she was coming in, and she's just right out of high school. She's only like 19 or something, and she's coming in and complaining about the boyfriend because the boyfriend was a World of Warcraft player, and he'd say, "Let's go out, let's do something." And she'd say, "Okay," and she'd go over to his apartment, and he would spend the entire evening just sitting there on the computer playing World of Warcraft. And I'm going, And you're like a live girl, and you're there.
With boobs.
Right.
And you want to spend time with him, and he can't, like, pull himself off the damn computer long enough to do anything. You
know? Dawn, I don't want to play devil's advocate here, but I will. She could have very easily brought her laptop over, created a character, and they could have spent time together on Azeroth. I'm just saying. Now, if she wants to make the effort to make the connection, it's not that hard. I mean, come on.
That's good. She's
unrealistic.
She could have entered his world.
Yeah,
that's right. There you go.
Instead of trying to yank him out.
Who's
out,
it always the man that has to compromise?
Yeah,
Dawn.
Really.
Seriously,
just bend a little bit.
Battle
that's
axis.
All we're asking.
God.
Yeah.
Yes, it's always the man. Who
and be
has
a
to
healer
compromise.
Too, because we need one of those. If you wouldn't mind, dire need.
All right.
Seriously,
I'm just going to keep that by the at the ready from now on.
There, no,
it's like 3 weeks in a row of dork talk.
Yeah, God, love it. Fridays are just rocking for me.
We never even got to hear about the Applebee's gig. We just started ragging on their menu, and then went off to talking about Nell.
By the way, Thomas Gill just types, "World of Warcraft players are weird."
I had a friend a couple years ago. My grandmother left me this rather wealthy, rather nice chunk of change, about 36 grand. So I went on this crazy little spending spree. I came back to visit my friends on the East Coast, and I hadn't seen them in like 7 years. So like majority of them were just like, "Dude, it's like let's go out, let's have fun." And I had a friend that bailed on me all but one night because he had online things that he was going to do, and they were all World of Warcraft related. And the only night that he actually came out and hung with us was the night where it got canceled, and the entire time he was in a bad mood because he wanted to be more than not be hanging out with these other people online in this imaginary world. And I'm just like, dude, you don't get to see me once but maybe a decade, and you know you're spending you're all checking your phone and sending updates via that, and instead of like interacting with people that you haven't physically seen and been around for a while. I don't know. Maybe it's just the fact that things have just been so bad for so long that you have to attach yourself to something that's virtual and clean and not really, you know, polluted by the fact that we all feel like subconsciously that kind of circling the drain here a little bit.
Well, that was, I mean, in a somewhat related note, this is why I don't have, like, if you look at my iPhone, I have no games of any kind installed because I know the amount of time. I mean, even if you are not a guy who has like a gaming problem, I know that the amount of time that you can just immediately have sucked away from you without even realizing. I mean, it's like you fire up your Plants vs. Zombies and then you look up and it's like 7 hours have gone by. And like there was a time actually when I was, and I can, you, there's moments where you get like a little window into how those things can happen, because when I was in my, I guess it would have been my early 20s, I mean, there were days when I went through a period where I was a really, really, really serious like online gamer in terms of like first person shooters, and I mean I would just lose entire days at a stretch, like in the blink. And this is when I was theoretically employed.
What was your fave?
I was a Quake guy.
Okay.
And so I worked at a place that had broadband, and it was like, I remember this. This is when, by the way, I knew that I was not yet mature enough to be operating my my own business or my own company in any way. Because some friends and I had started, and I was actually talking about this earlier this week. It was sort of similar to this. We'd all gotten fired at the same time, and we thought, internet broadcasting, that's the way of the future, which... It was just further in the future than I think we anticipated, because everybody was still like in a 14.4 modem or whatever.
Yeah.
So we got this business, and we had like broadband at the office, and we thought like, this is how we're going to make our pile of cash. We'll do, you know, we bring a new form of entertainment to the people. But first, Quake. And and we had broadband, and we immediately, like, just all of us at the company, I mean, it was like how you hear about like the Chinese system of aqueducts and dams and canals just collapsing because of the opium addiction that spread through the country like a rampaging virus.
Yeah. And
it was bad, like, at the company that all of us worked at together. I mean, everybody at the company had like a Quake problem, and so there was no one to actually. And of course, and we were kind of a self-contained group because we were a small business, and we didn't really have, you know, we're all like radio nerds, so we didn't really have a lot of outside friends. And I don't think any of us had a steady girlfriend or anything at the time. So there was like no outside perspective. There was no one to show up and just go, when's the last time you guys like left the house or changed your clothes?
Killing.
Seriously, what's going on here? There was no one to do. And the nadir of that, I remember going to work one day, and this other guy, and he and I were sort of the co- I don't know if it was like the president or whatever. We were like the co-chairman of the company. We were the guys who sort of founded it and sort of ran it. We were the Gates and Allen of this company. But I remember clearly. I mean, it's like, you know, and I'm not a dumb guy, and he's a smart guy. I mean, he's probably smarter than I am. And the two of us going to work. Up at like the third floor of our three-story building that we got for like no reason, and sitting down, and he was sitting, and it was sort of like Dawn and I are now. He was sitting on one side of this massive desk we had, and I sat on the other. And this is like 8 a.m. in the morning. You know, here we are, captains of our own destiny, steering our own fates through the river of life. And he and I sat down, and we just looked at each other, and he went, "Well, shall we?" And he like cracked his knuckles, and I went, and I didn't even have to ask what I meant. Yes, we shall. And we just fired up like the Quake game. And I remember then the next thing I remember looking up, and it was like 11 o'clock at night. And jeez. I had no idea. I had no idea what had transpired during that, you know, what, 15 hours or something. I think that was the day that we actually said, maybe we ought to, and we actually put out a memo just forbidding the playing of Quake on the company intranet at that time, which I think, by the way, I read somewhere that it was like Intel or somebody, or it might have actually been Microsoft at one point, had to put out a memo banning the playing of Quake on the Microsoft system, or the playing of Doom, because Doom was actually consuming not just bandwidth, but was actually consuming so much time, so much work, so many man hours from people who were supposed to be like coding. So, I mean, that...
There's Emerson, stay in lane again. God bless him. Need more like him.
What a dedicated employee he is. All right. So, about Applebee's.
Yeah.
Like a year ago, you were talking about doing this Applebee's gig,
yeah.
But then you came back the next week and said the Applebee's gig had been canceled.
Yeah, that was the one in Gresham. That was the Gresham Applebee's. So, I upgraded, and I got a second chance to do the Longview.
Fancy.
Applebee's.
Wow. Yes, that's right. In scenic downtown Longview, Washington, at the Mecca of Comedy, Applebee's.
Now, is this like a company-wide thing they're doing? I mean, is Applebee's corporate...
I think so, because I called to get the specific time. I called the Applebee's, and like, you know, hey, this is blah 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 from Applebee's. Now featuring late night. What can I do for you? And I'm just like, okay, are you guys doing comedy night? Yeah, that's our late night. That's what we're doing now. So now 10 o'clock at Applebee's, they're kind of working in, like, they have karaoke on Tuesdays, and I guess comedy now on Thursdays.
You close your eyes, it's just like being at the Playboy Club.
That's right. Yeah. But no, this was everything you would imagine comedy in Longview, Washington, at an Applebee's to be.
How do you tailor your humor for the?
Well, see, and that's the thing is the Gresham Applebee's. They made it very clear that they wanted it to be a squeaky clean show. So like no sexual references, no drug references, and if there were like maybe just if you wanted to try and push it like in that, it had to be very very, you know, implied kind of jokes. We get out to Longview, And I do my set, which I had written that day. I read a whole bunch of brand new stuff that was all like, it was all about my mom and how like completely, you know, technologically uninterested she is and everything else. And I thought it was pretty good. And we get there, and the woman after the show was just like, yeah, you guys could have been much dirtier. We were, because it was the first time they were doing it there. And the guy on stage was talking about all kinds of things that would be more blue or more closer to a blue type of set. And even after he was done, they're just like, yeah, sorry about the hecklers and the drunks and the 40-year-old guy in the Lucky 13 Matt Hardy outfit that was, you know, trying to give you a hard time. And, you know, we were very much encouraged to be much more filthy and dirty.
Huh. So Longview is sort of the Wild West of the Applebee's world.
Absolutely, it's
an untamed frontier.
They like it racy in Longview.
Because every comedy show might be their last.
So now are you going to be going back? Is that going to be like an ongoing gig for you?
Well, I guess you're going to do it once a month. And the guy that booked it was there also. He kind of emceed it. And yeah, I bit the bullet. I went first. And it was a hard road to hoe. But afterwards, they said that they wanted to bring us back next month. Us meaning comedy in general, not us three specifically. But the audience came by afterwards and like, you guys are going to be back next month. They're like, well, there'll be new comics, not just us three. And they were all like, oh. But I don't know if people in Longview were just like, yeah, there's more than just three comics in Portland, Oregon. That's there's more of y'all. All right, sweet.
Excellent.
Feed them after midnight. Get them wet. Show them some sunlight.
Mr. Big Joe Willig is here. We'll do another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 coming up here in just a few. We'll do that. That is focusing on the life and career of Mr. Steve Martin. So that is on the way and so forth. At the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
But let's do our snuff watch.
Here is your snuff watch for Friday, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Retired pro wrestler Macho Man Randy Savage, 58, was killed this morning in Seminole, Florida, when the Jeep he was driving jumped a median and hit a tree. His wife, Barbara El Pafo, 56, was in the passenger seat. She was injured. She was expected to be released from a hospital. Savage's real name was Ralph Mario Pafo, according to the Wrestling Federation's website. Yes, that would be the word I'm looking for. The couple lived in Seminole, Florida. An investigation is underway, but a highway patrol report said that his 2009 Jeep Wrangler jumped the median, lost control for unknown reasons as it was traveling westbound. Highway patrol report said Pafo may have suffered a medical event, however, I guess, which means he might have had a heart attack.
That's, well, the early reports have said that they believe it was a heart attack, but they obviously won't know until there's an autopsy.
However, this can't be confirmed until an autopsy is performed. His vehicle traveled over the raised concrete median divider, crossed the eastbound lanes over the outside curb, and collided head-on with a tree. As a pro wrestler, he was known for his catchphrases.
Ooh, yeah.
Wow, that's unnerving.
Thank you.
And also, can you dig it? Can you do the can you dig
can
it?
Can you dig it?
All right, you got to work it into your act like now.
After he retired from wrestling, he became known for his Slim Jim commercials.
Snip into it!
The Wrestling Federation and the maker of Slim Jim meat sticks expressed sympathies.
Our meat sticks will be at half-mast.
Yes, we're saddened by the loss, said ConAgra Foods. Randy was a beloved ambassador for the Slim Jim brand for many years and will be greatly missed.
Wow.
The beefy, juicy taste.
Okay. Jesus, God. Sorry. So we were talking about this last hour. So that, you know, it's not like it's going to, you know, ruin my weekend or anything, but I was legitimately bummed out this morning because I was online and I was doing something or other, and then I saw the breaking news tweet from CNN come by, and it was, you know, the Macho Man, which is just... You know, and it's one of those things where everybody dies at some point, you know, but it's like everybody goes, but you just don't really anticipate. Like, he's just not a guy who's on your radar as a guy who's going to, you know, I mean, it really does catch you.
He's a constant.
Well, it's like, I remember when, when Ed McMahon died, I remember, you know, everybody was bummed out about Ed McMahon dying, but also he was like 90 and he'd been very bad health. And like, you saw him like on the, like, it's not going to shock anybody when Zsa Zsa Gabor finally dies.
No, but like if all of a sudden you get up tomorrow and turn out, you know, Roddy Piper was dead.
Don't even joke about that.
That would be horrible. I'm not joking.
Too soon, Dawn.
I have got any ideas.
That's not a joke. That's an example of something that would be shocking and horrible.
Hell will never come to Frogtown as far
saying,
as I'm concerned.
That is, you know, that's you don't want to give the universe any suggestions.
Ed McMahon was seriously, he was kind of like sitting by the door with his bag packed, waiting for the Angel of Death to kind of
checking
his watch.
It's like in any minute now.
Because that's, you know, so when something like, you know, like Randy Savage dies, though, it's like on the one hand, like you've got it sucks and the sadness and the whatever, and then on the other hand, it's also like that you get that. You know, you get the shock and the stun aspect of it, it's just weird and it's sort of surreal. But I was, I haven't really like watched. I haven't been a wrestling fan for some time, probably since I was, maybe 15, yeah. 16. That's kind of when I sort of started to drift away from it. And then it was really when I discovered rock music. I mean, that was kind of the thing, is that rock sort of took the place of wrestling in terms of like all my weird, strangely androgynous and or homoerotic male figures got swapped out. No longer Hulk Hogan, now Robert Plant.
Yeah.
It was
closer to a female shape.
Seriously. I mean, so it's like, you know, I just basically, and it's like, so I went from wrestling to Guns N' Roses. I just traded one guy in a kilt for another. I retained like a soft spot for wrestling forever. And then when I lived in Salt Lake, I had this group of friends who were all like freakishly, I mean, not that these things are mutually exclusive, but I mean, this is, you know, I think in the last couple of years, people have revised their opinion of a lot of this stuff. But I had a friend of mine, she was a double PhD and I think was working on, I don't know, something else, like some other degree just to drive up the score. But she was also like a massive pro wrestling fan. And it's like, I don't know, she spoke like seven languages or something and was also like a Filipino knife fighter. And then
like you do.
And then was like a big WWF fan. And so I actually went to see the W, and I guess it was still the WWF at that point, but they came to the Delta Center in Salt Lake, and all I remember was that the only person I remember being on the card that I was on the ticket was Coco Beware.
Yeah.
And his it was like a parrot or something that he had with him.
That was but was this during the high energy days where it was Coco Beware and Owen Hart?
This would have been 95.
Okay, so it was probably Coco's solo days still, because it was towards the end of his career. Do you know what Coco Beware's finishing move was?
No,
it's called the Ghostbuster.
Really?
Yes, and it was actually banned from professional wrestling because it was actually injuring and ending careers. It was basically what it was. It was you get the guy up in the suplex position, but instead of like laying back into onto the ground, he actually just threw his legs out from underneath you and dropped you. Your head.
Wow,
that was the Ghostbuster. Oh. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is like, you know, anybody who, you know, sort of people sort of will mock or, you know, they'll kind of arch an eyebrow, you know, about professional wrestling, and we could discuss for a long time whether or not it's a sport, but it is certainly. But I would say it is certainly. Whether or not you consider it a sport, I would say it is certainly an athletic. What's the word? An athletic pursuit. I mean, it certainly requires like a level of endurance and physicality that probably most things do not. And I'm frankly surprised that more people aren't injured. I mean, not that those guys don't take their job seriously, because they do, but it's like you're engaging in high risk behavior a lot. And I mean, it's like, well, have we all seen Beyond the Mat? Was that the documentary?
Yes, I just
where it's
watched
like
that.
Jake the Snake is sort of just like going from, you know, he's like playing like a high school gym or something. And that's the thing where it's like, I remember watching Jake the Snake at WrestleMania 3.
Yeah.
Where he was just like the biggest thing in the world. That's the WrestleMania, by the way, where Alice Cooper was in attendance.
That's right.
Because he had the python in the bag or whatever.
Damien.
Yeah. And I mean, which, by the way, still holds the record for the most attended indoor event.
It's over 110.
It's 93,000 people.
Yeah.
At the Pontiac Silverdome, which was, I mean, a huge, huge deal, because that was where like Hogan was wrestling Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, didn't we talk about this at KPAM?
We did, yeah.
Again, hard to imagine that they decided that we weren't going to be called back at any point. But Randy Savage was a huge part of that, and I kind of drifted back into being a wrestling fan in the mid '90s when I had a roommate. My roommate Kurt was a huge wrestling fan, and again, we had this sort of circle of friends. They were all into, and that's where I started watching like the extreme, like the East Coast wrestling stuff, like ECW.
Dude,
yeah, the ECW, which was fantastic, which was my first introduction really to like that. that kind of really hardcore, like, you know, with the juicing and the blood and the...
Paul Heyman was I don't know if he was a genius or a madman when it came to that, because he basically had it in, like, bingo halls in Philadelphia, and the fans were almost as terrifying as...
It's a tough crowd.
Yeah, like, juggalos are like, I'm gonna cross the street, I'm gonna walk over there.
It's funny, actually, because the guy who introduced me to ECW was from Philly.
Yeah.
And he was like, dude, have you ever seen ECW? I'm like, no. And he's like, we're getting a pay-per-view this weekend. And it was like not even a question. Like, it was like a... It was
and
like
he punched himself in the face.
It's like, you will sit, you will watch. And so I lived, actually, I've talked about that. I lived at this place, this house of dudes in Salt Lake. And it was me and three guys. It had been four. I was like the cousin Oliver. There was like these four guys who lived there, three brothers and their friend, all from Philly.
Yeah.
Or F in Philly, as they always had to call it.
F, yeah.
One of the guys got married, moved away, and so they had a slot. And so, like, I needed a place to live because I'd just been fired. And so I moved in. So it was like me and these three guys from Philadelphia, two of whom are brothers, and like always angry at stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And they would and they were totally down with the ECW. And it's like, they would get these pay-per-views. And they told me, they're like, you're watching it. And so I was like, okay. And I mean, it was mind-blowing. I mean, it was just I'd never seen anything like that. Whereas, like, they had this was, I think, the match where they had a stepladder wrapped in barbed wire.
Yeah.
And they, like, the guy was on his, you know, he was knocked out or whatever, and so he's laying face down, and then the bad guys come along, and they put the stepladder wrapped in barbed wire across him, like, parallel to his body, and then they just get on top of it, and they're just jumping up and down on it.
Yeah.
And then the guy gets up, and he is just, like, bleeding like nobody's, which is clearly, like, not, I mean, that's not, yeah, like... gag work going on there. I mean, that is like actual. Clearly, that is the way. That's the rules of the road when you're wrestling.
He's got
way.
A lot of squibs on him. That is impressive.
It was, you know, it was, and that I think is when I came back around to really, you know, appreciating it, just how intense it is.
There's a couple of different things about ECW that I love to watch, and when you watch Beyond the Mat, you realize that Paul Heyman had this out of his mom's house. Like, talk about down on your luck, just putting all your chips in the ring to see if it's going to actually take off. But there's a shot of, like, his mom ironing, and then, like, if you pan to the left, there's a guy in a suit with a spotlight on him and that real high-end camera, like, filming all these, like, interviews and everything else. But you had the Sandman and one of my personal favorites, Taz,
yeah,
whose motto was, beat me if you can, survive if I let you. And I'm just like, oh,
awesome.
My God, the most incredible New Jack, who was this guy who was, like, completely honest, like, yeah, I've been to prison a couple times, and would walk down to the ring with a garbage can filled with various things to beat you with.
I remember that guy.
Yeah, and he would walk to the ring, and he would just throw it in the ring and then climb up, and there was the saddest thing ever. You can probably still find it on YouTube, but this kid was, like, maybe 15, 16 years old, and he just wanted to be a part of a professional wrestling. So Paul Heyman agreed to have him come in and do a match, like a little novelty match. And he was supposed to go up against one of the Dudleys in, like, this total fluff match, but the Dudley was injured and couldn't do it, so they sent him in against New Jack. And New Jack just took this kid apart. And the sad thing is, like, the dad is standing filming this whole thing, watching his son just get brutalized. And he's like, someone please stop this. Where are the police? Somebody, my God. And all the Philly fans are like, yeah, get him! Get him!
If I remember correctly, now, were the Dudleys, were they like the whole family of hillbillies?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Wasn't that their thing?
There was...
They had like the big-ass Coke bottle glasses.
With the tape in the middle, yeah. Like the tie-dyed outfits. And
yeah.
They're like, yeah, we're brothers, but one's black, one's white, and then we had like the third Dudley, who was like the scrawny guy who, like, year before was like an elementary school English teacher. Like, that was his day job, and he's like, that didn't work out. Now let me try pro wrestling. That shouldn't be too bad. But yeah, ECW was like legitly like, okay, these guys aren't even pretending like it's fake.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
So this is really what I'm saying. So the so wrestling is really, I mean, it's and you can thank Vince McMahon for most of this, that it has made such huge inroads into the popular culture. I mean, that's a guy that there needs to be like the definitive book on because, you know, because he inherited that whole thing from his dad.
Yeah, but the thing is, for me, I blame Vince for my drifting away from it, because I mean, I understood even when I was a kid that it was kind of a soap opera, but with like really huge actors and actresses in it. But it just got so insulting to my intelligence how stupid these like feuds and everything else would be. Like when you had the Undertaker like putting dudes in caskets and like him versus Jake the Snake and or him versus Big Boss Man. These were good feuds. I liked watching that. But then he had like these ridiculous, totally moronic angles. And after a while, I'm just like, I can't handle watching this.
Do you remember that point as somebody watching wrestling when you realized that these guys had just had this huge argument and then one challenged the other one to a fight and yet they've already arranged the time and the date for it before the argument because they end the argument and they're like, I challenge you to fight me and then Vince McMahon is standing there and you could see this next Tuesday at 7 p.m. and like, but they just had the fight. You just challenged them right now.
I think that...
Then you go... Oh.
The subtleties of that may have escaped me when I was younger.
There's something really awesome on Netflix if you have a chance to watch it. It's called The Rise and Fall of the WCW, and that just really sheds a lot of light both on the WCW and the WWF.
Putting that in my queue right now.
Do it to it, because it is seriously like, I was always like a WWF like specific fan. I thought WCW was kind of lame, but you really learn like how Vince kind of ran his market and how like eventually it got to a point where it was just like too huge and was beating WWF week in, week out and all their ratings. And it just kind of fell apart. And then at the very end, when like it was at its lowest point, Vince comes strolling in and just buys
the whole thing
from Ted Turner.
And I, like a lot of people, I didn't really care at that point. I mean, I had no reason to care. I'll put it that way. But I sort of was like a WWE loyalist because that's what I'd grown up with.
Yeah.
And the WCW was viewed as this incursion. I mean, and it was. It's hard to explain. I think now why grown men actually were like taking. I mean, because even then I was like 20 something.
Yeah.
And it's like, and again, like I was not even. I wouldn't even have called myself like a wrestling fan at that point. And you know, and it's like I'm not just some guy that just fell off the bumpkin truck or whatever. But there I was, like honestly, like getting into like you know to squabbles with my room. Made about it. I'm like, WCW sucks. It's for posers. And
all they got's Goldberg. Everybody else just a bunch of Johnny Come Latelys.
And there was that whole thing where they were like rating the WWE for wrestlers, and you know, and but you know, Vince McMahon. I have my friend Chris, who I first met because he was the musical director for Bigger Than Jesus. He's one of the smartest guys I've ever met in my entire life. I mean, just flat out genius. I mean, just brilliant. And has several degrees in you know in music theory and in, like advanced composition and music management and music business and is just brilliant. And is a huge wrestling fan. And he and I have had long conversations about Vince McMahon and how you know in a way Vince McMahon and Gene Simmons are very similar. They are analogs for one another.
Very true.
In that. They both took something that existed at a certain way on a certain level at a certain aspect of American society, and they made it bigger and louder and brighter and more polished and more theatrical and more accessible, and as a result, gave it this huge international exposure and huge platform, and really changed the way that industry is done. I mean, Kiss revolutionized the way the music industry operates. Whatever anybody thinks of their music, they changed the way that music as a business and as a presentation, the showmanship of business, the showmanship of music, you know, was changed. By Kiss forever. Vince McMahon did the same thing with wrestling, but it's like, but as you just said, it's like that is sort of that's the double-edged sword because in a way, all of the stuff that they contributed to the elevation or to the advancement, you know, as a global commodity of that particular art form, I mean, was balanced by the fact that it became bloated and it became off-putting to a lot of people, and it lost a lot of the raw energy that made it really appealing in the first place. I mean, it really is.
He created or coined the phrase sports entertainment.
Right.
And previous to that, I mean, it didn't really exist. I mean, if you go back far enough, a lot of people's grandparents and great-grandparents back in the days of, like, Gorgeous George and, you know, Playboy Bunny Rose. And
my grandmother.
Yeah. I mean, these were, like, even older than, you know, we are now. Grown people going to Madison Square Garden and not just like cheering, but like becoming irate. Like, you know, like if their favorite guy lost, you'd be surprised if there wasn't a riot in the streets.
My mother was a huge fan of roller derby in Los Angeles when she was young. And she told me when I was growing up that was her girlhood dream, was she wanted to be a roller derby star.
That's awesome.
Was it be a derbyist or yeah, but either way, I mean,
my grandmother would actually, living in the Northwest, my grandmother would watch the NWA, which is the Northwest Wrestling Association. And that is where you had, I mean, you had all of those. You had, you know.
The Midnight Express, the Rock and Roll Express,
and she would just
Haystack.
And just sitting there, Haystack. Are you talking about Haystack's Calhoun?
Yeah.
and we're such idiots. But she would just sit there with like her, you know, like her mason jar full of Bloody Mary, and just, you know, screaming at the television, just chain smoking and drinking. And every now and again, she would go to see them, like where they would come to, like, you know, like the local, like VFW or like the local whatever, wherever it is they were, you know, like at the, like, you know, like the Moose Lodge or something. And the deal, like, that she would go to see them, and the deal is that they, you could actually bring up, you could bring foreign objects with you. That they would, and you go and put them in the ring, and they would then use them, you know, in the fight.
Wow!
But you had to, but at certain points they were sort of like strippers, because at certain points they would actually stop the match or slow down the match, and they would wait for the audience to actually come up and put money on the side of the ring before they continue, because that was when it was, that was before Vince McMahon sort of put up this weird Wizard of Oz-esque curtain to cloak the fact that it was a huge money making industry. You know, yeah. he glossed over that with just all of this, with just this huge. Huge, you know, bright and shiny facade to cover up, you know, or at least distract you in some way from the fact that it was just this just gigantic money making enterprise. These guys, though, they would just stop, and they wouldn't do anything until like people would come up and they put like $5 in the side of the ring. And if you wanted them to like use like a frying pan or like a rolling pin or something, you had to bring it up, and then you had to put like a $5 down. And so it was like the highlight of her life at one point when she did take in. You know, it was like a meat tenderizer or something. And then, you know, and like also a $10 bill. And the guy's like, picked up the $10 bill, put it in his pants or whatever. And then, you know, once he had that, then he picked up the meat tenderizer and looked at my grandmother and kind of nodded his head like, all right, you're going to get what you pay for. And then just went to work on the other guy, you know.
He's just like, no.
Well, my grandmother's just screaming like, kill him, you know, which is awesome. And she looked exactly like that old woman from the Maxine comics, like the grumpy woman with the curlers in her hair. So, I mean, wrestling is in a strange way. It's like they say that, like, you know, jazz is the only form of music created in America. Yeah. Wrestling, in a weird way, is like the great American contribution to the world of sport.
Well, the sad thing is it's become such a caricature of itself here. Over in Japan, it still very much is respected as a sport, along with sumo, which is like legitimate, and then you have like professional wrestling, and then like all kinds of like shoot fighting and stuff like that, where it's still very much honored and respected as the event that it is. But what you just described, I mean, I just kind of imagine like big sweaty plumber looking dude in a unitard come rolling up to someone's grandmother, just like, you want a ladder dance? You got to put down $20.
Yeah,
that is terrifying. But so, no, well, back in my hometown, we would go to the Hershey Park Arena, and we would watch pay-per-view events or WWF's In Your House or whatever was coming to town next. And I remember distinctly there was a steel cage match with Shawn Michaels and the British Bulldog.
Yeah.
And Shawn Michaels was a heel at the time, which is a bad guy. And we were booing him, and this woman turned around in the row in front of us. And like mouth like a jack-o'-lantern, like she seriously had like one tooth on top and two on bottom in offsetting positions, and she just said, "I likes the Shawn Michaels."
That's awesome.
And the group of us just fell in back into our chairs, laughing hysterically because we're just like, "Wow!" And we're all in high school, and I think we're the most highly educated people in the room. But it was our thing, and we loved it dearly. But eventually, we kind of like I said, you just had to drift away from it, because I don't know if you just saw it for what it was, or if it just went into this massive downward spiral.
Well, and I think at a certain point too, it becomes like less. It becomes like uninteresting porn, where you realize that all of the window dressing, all of the plot, or all of the storyline is just leading up to the same kind of action that you've seen. You know, it all leads to the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's one guy picking up and throwing him down, and like, you know, and then the guy gets up, and then, you know, and it is almost like porn. That, you know, stop, change positions, stop, change positions, and then eventually you get to the pin. Eventually, your finishing move. you know, and then you're done, and it's, you know, and they and some of it is, you know, some of it is amateur, and some of it is like pro amateur, and some of it is big, and you know, has huge production value, and you know, and some of it is you know, and some of it is franchise, and some of it isn't, but it all basically comes down to, you know, the match, which is, you know, and I think at a certain point you've seen it all, and you kind of need to step back, because there's just nothing, there is no longer any interest there, because it's like, how exciting Can they make it without it being? And the other thing about pro wrestling, not unlike Kiss or not unlike a lot of films are this way. Like we talked about this with superhero movies. See, we can all these things are all sort of equivalent in a way. Lest anybody think that we're just spending too much time talking about Randy Savage. These things are all very analogous because just like superhero movies keep adding bad guys as the franchise goes on, because so it is with music and so like with Kiss and so it was with pro wrestling, where they keep adding and adding and adding to it because it's like they feel like every time the spectacle has to be bigger than the last time you saw it. But at a certain point, you just kind of go, it's just too much. Like
my gland is burned out. It can't produce any more serotonin.
And it's like so big that you no longer feel any visceral connection to it because it just seems like you are watching a Broadway production. And it's like it loses whatever sort of, you know, whatever kind of primal adrenaline rush it originally had.
Michael Bay.
Yeah.
Well, it's like a roller coaster. I mean, you can't just have it be all upward climb and no downward descent and kind of slow part. Like, it has to kind of crash and crescendo and go down and then have to rebuild itself, because you have to be able to kind of reinvest yourself into it at some point in time, because you can only go, like you said, you can only give so much to it before it just becomes like you become numb to it after a while. I think that's kind of what happened. I just got numb and disinterested and kind of just wandered away and, you know, discovered, you know, comedy and chicks and stuff like that, drugs and rock and roll. And I picked up my graphite blade and I raised it in the midday sun.
Awesome. Fantastic. There you go. All right.
I could seriously talk about all these things forever and a day. There isn't enough hours in the day for
me. No, you and me both. Don, your favorite wrestling memory?
I got nothing.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. All right. We'll wrap up the Snuff Watch here in a minute. We got more news coming up. We'll do the Humor Me Comedy 101 for today, which is Steve Martin. Real quickly, as we close this out, I will... Yes?
I'm just saying, I literally, the only time I ever used to watch wrestling was I just was completely enamored of Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Yeah.
And he was so insanely entertaining that I would watch wrestling just to watch him. I really had no particular interest in wrestling as an art form or really in any other wrestlers. But if I saw, like, in the TV guide that there was something coming up and he was part of it, I would sit down and I would watch wrestling. I loved him.
Yeah, he was one of the ones that, for my money, he, like Jake the Snake Roberts, they weren't the biggest. They didn't have, like, the perfect build or the perfect anything. Their finishing move wasn't the flashiest, but their stage presence
was charisma
captivating.
To burn.
Yeah, like they, like anybody else, you could send in your Ultimate Warriors or all your other big guys there. But for my money, I would love to just sit and watch a guy who had like a legitimate personality outside of the fact of his pecs.
Well, and he could act. I mean, he played the character and he was the character and he pulled it off. You never ever got this. I mean, you knew on some level that yes, he's taking part in the same business of show that is all of wrestling. So you knew that he was. But the thing is, it's just like so many. The other guys, like, again, like watching porn, there's so many, you know, actors in the business that are just horrible at the acting part of it. And Roddy wasn't. He was good.
And this sounds like a dumb comparison to make, again, the porn wrestling thing, but it's like as much as we all find Ron Jeremy aesthetically flawed, let's say.
Well said.
I will say that in a weird way, the great thing about Ron Jeremy, and I think the reason he became so popular, I mean, you know, there's a lot of guys, you know, who have a big schlong or whatever, but it's like he always had that weird gleam in his eye, like he realized how absurd the whole thing was, and so he... And I don't mean this in the obvious way, but he was having a good time. Like, he obviously was just, he just thought the whole thing was, like, you know, was hilarious and crazy and whatever. And he's like, hey, look at me getting to do this for a living. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And he just had this weird sort of, like, can you believe this? And the thing with Roddy Piper is he always, you could tell he just was having a ball with that character and just being that guy. I was actually going to, as we wrap this up, I was going to ask if you had a favorite, because mine has to do with Roddy Piper. I was going to say you had a single favorite moment from your years in wrestling fandom.
Oh,
man. A single incident.
Honestly, I will say, because it's kind of hard for me not to just have Roddy on the brain now. But mine actually came after all those years, and it was on Court and Fats. They had Roddy Piper in there. He was there to promote his son,
Colt,
who was now becoming a UFC fighter. And what it was Roddy Piper. They were interviewing everybody and giving equal time, and that was what I really appreciated about it. And Roddy was doing a very good job of kind of like balancing it out. But when we got on the topic of Roddy Piper's life, you find out all the stuff that he went through as a kid and everything else. And then like you're like, wow, there's like this whole other person attached to it. And then he just dropped the floor out of everybody in the room when he just went on like this 5-minute quoting of King Lear.
I heard that.
Flawlessly. And I'm just like, no one could speak after it was done. You're just like, wow.
I think that was the same day that we had him on, because I think he was doing the whole building, and I heard that. I heard him doing that, because I was sitting there like listening to him. I was in my office upstairs, and I was looking at the radio, and I heard him doing that, and it was the thing where you just turn and you stare at the radio, like, for no reason. Like, staring at the radio, like, am I hearing this?
Like Bill Hicks says, like a dog being shown a card trick.
Yeah, I mean, because he was on talking about his son, and I remember, you know, and of course, there's that thing that, you know what will, the one thing that will make, the one thing that makes a guy cry or tear up, it's like, you always, you learn this on that, like, you know, on any of those, like, rehab shows, on those reality shows. Typically what happens on those is, like, it's like if their dad is crying, then it's like they turn on, but it's like, so we have Piper in the studio with his kid, and it's like he's talking about how proud he is of his kid, and it's like he starts choking up while talking about Colt, his son, and how proud he is that he's stepping out of his. He's like, you know, he's like, I cast a big shadow, and you know, and he's, it would have been easy for him just to be lost, with me as a dad, because I got, because everybody knows me, because I got a big mouth, and but he's out there and he's making his own way, and I'm really proud. And then he kind of chokes up, and he actually just has to like fight off the tears talking about his kid. And it was clearly not an act.
Did you see? Put the tears in a chokehold, or possibly a figure four leg lock.
He was, I mean, it was obvious, and not a thing he was doing as a front. I mean, it was obviously he was just like radiating pride for his son, and it was like all of us in the room were just like, "That's great, Roddy. That's wonderful. I'm so glad you came here to say that." It was like it was just like the weirdest moment, because he was so like unguarded about it. But yeah, he had no pretense about, you know, never talking about Roddy Piper like he's dead. He's not. But he had no pretense about telling any of the stories that you could tell that he was a little embarrassed of, like that time he got paid to wrestle a bear or something, which I'm not making up.
I know, and
I was like, "Is it true you wrestled a bear?" And he's like, "Oh," and he turned like bright red, and he's like, "Yeah." He's like, "Well, when you're poor, you'll do most anything for money." And some guy had, a bottle of whiskey and $100, and he goes, "Wrestle a bear," and so I wrestled the bear, and you're just like, "You're awesome." I will say, just as a final to my all time favorite wrestling moment has to do with Roddy Piper, and I believe, and I didn't get a chance to ask him about this, but I believe it was actually, what's it, Colt, when he was young, because I think he's 20 something now, early 20s, and I think it was when Colt was like 8 or 9. Piper had, I think it was for the WCW, Piper had done this thing of he had retired. He had retired from the WCW, and he was just, and he was going out, and he was, very public, and they made a whole thing about his retirement. And he was, he was trying to take care of all family business. He was trying to tie up all loose ends. And so he was going around making peace, burying the hatchet with everybody that he had a grudge with. And this was, I think, when Hogan had become a heel. He was Hollywood Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
And so Piper's going around, and they did this whole thing, like this farewell tour of like 3 weeks where Piper's trying to make peace with all of the guys he's had grudge matches with. And the last thing is he goes into the ring, and it's like this huge, huge event, and Hogan's there, and Piper's just dressed in street clothes or whatever, and he's got his kid with him, and he comes, he goes, and he says, "Well, I'm just, Hogan, we've had our differences, and just, I've come here, just want to say I want to put it all behind us, and I've always respected you as a wrestler and as a man, and so I just hope that we can just, be friends after this, because I'm moving on to the next chapter of my life, and, I wish you well in your travels, and I just hope we can just put all this aside." And Hogan, of course, being the heel, just did something, like Piper put out his hand and Hogan did like slapped it away or something. And then Piper did the thing of like he looked down and he did like this little like count to 10 thing. And he said, "Well, my son is here. And so, I don't want to cause any trouble. I'm just hoping that we can end this like men and end this like grownups and just go our separate ways and not have any bad blood. And I don't want to do anything. My boy is here and I don't want to be violent, when the end is on a peaceful note. So if we can just once and for all," and he puts out the hand, and Hogan does the thing of then like reaching forward and like giving him the finger in the chest and like pushing him.
Yeah.
And Piper, just does, because he did have this like inherent ability. He had this great sense of timing. He does the greatest thing I've ever seen, where he it's like you forget that he's in front of like 50,000 people or whatever, where he turns and he gets down on one knee and he's talking to Colt, who's like, again, 7 or 8 years old, and he goes, "Colt, I'm going to need you to go back to the dressing room. Daddy's got something he needs to do."
Yeah.
Okay. And he like pats him on the head, and then he does this great thing of like Colt getting out of the ring, and I don't know to what extent you like prep the kid for that, but Colt climbs out of the ring. And Piper does this great thing of, with his back to Hogan, he counts it. He stands the entire time watching his kid go down out of the ring, down the aisle, until he's out of sight. And I mean, which is like a good 15, 20 seconds. And then he waits like another five or so. And then he just turns around and he like hooks his thumbs in his belt, you know, at Hogan. And he just says, let's go. And it was like, you're just like, that's awesome. And I was like 27 or something. And I was just at home, like just all but blubbering. So there you go.
That's
all right.
That for the win.
So there you go. That is our snuff watch for today. So there you go. Mr. Mr. Macho Man, Randy Savage of the Rick Emerson radio program.
That was one long snuff watch.
Really? Well, after all they've given us. Duh.
I was pretty thrilled when I moved here and found out that Roddy Piper actually lived here because he, you know, was not like I said, not only my favorite wrestler, but really the only wrestler I ever really liked because I didn't watch wrestling, but I adored him. I remember being so excited when he made They Live, and yeah. It was awesome, and thinking maybe he was going to have some kind of like hot movie career. I was like, go Roddy, go. I just was just so behind him.
I remember just seeing They Live and and not knowing really what to. I had a friend who worked at a theater, and I said, They Live, and he was just like, and that was, I think, he had seen it the night before it opened, yeah. And he just looked at me, he's like, go see it. And I was really, and he goes, because Carpenter, I think, was kind of on a losing streak,
yeah,
about then, and he was like, see it, you gotta see it. And I was like, all right. And I remember sitting there watching it and just thinking, like, literally thinking, like, this is too good to be true. Like, this has to start sucking at some point.
What's the matter, baby?
And I mean, and he was a talk show host. That's the other thing about Roddy Piper.
Yeah.
His character, he did Piper's Pit. He hosted a talk show. And so I remember when I was a kid, just on some level, that was the other reason he was so great, is because he was actually hosting a talk. He was a broadcaster.
Yeah.
You know, he was doing interviews, doing whatever, which is even then kind of what I wanted to do. So when I moved, to Portland, because I would, you know, kind of come through here with my parents when I was a kid. But when I moved here, and then I heard that he owned like a muffler shop or something here, which is just, you know. So no, we'll find a reason. We'll find a reason to get him on the show.
Oh yes,
we'll find a reason to get him in here.
Just one of the few people I know I'll be genuinely starstruck by, because I had such love for him, such almost no. So I watched Piper. Again, I didn't even follow wrestling. I would watch him. I would watch Piper's yeah. Pit. I loved him.
Well, dude, the infamous coconut over Jimmy Snoopafly snook his head. Like, and for those of you who don't know, a coconut is very hard to break. But over a person's skull, I mean that is like infamous. That is like people who don't even like wrestling will be like, yeah, I remember watching that and being aghast. But no, I followed his acting career. They Live, my personal favorite that I saw on USA Up All Night, Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Oh, yeah.
Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Epic. And like, I'll mention them, people won't know. I'm just like, you know what? I don't even care that you don't know.
Rick is horrified. I'm aware of Hell Comes to Frogtown. I've never seen it. As much as I love Roddy Piper, I've still never seen that movie.
My sister had to send away and spend like about $45, maybe $50 for a VHS copy of it because it's so hard to find. I think she bought off a Craigslist.
Actually, what we'll do, because we're so over time here, we'll take a break here in a second. We'll actually come back with a little more news and then Humor Me Comedy 101. I'll play the Hell Comes to Frogtown segment into the break. I also, by the way, saw that on All Night on USA with Rhonda Shear.
Who did a
layout in Playboy a few years later, by the way, which is hot.
And is now selling bras on QVC.
Well, that's a woman who knows her support.
Yes, she does.
And she looks great, by the way.
I got to tell you, seriously, you got to, and I don't mean this in a sleazy way, but you got to see the layout of her in Playboy, because it's so in keeping with her sort of persona, at least. I don't know what she's really like, but I mean her care, because it's all done in a truck stop. And where she's like, she has one of those like truck stop waitress outfits on for a lot of it, and portions of it pulled up or pushed aside or whatever. And then she's wearing, and this is before I think this sort of thing became ironically fashionable, she has like the trucker hat, and she has like the waitress pad, like she's getting ready to take, you know, like
your order,
Adam and Eve on a raft and wreck 'em, you know, or whatever you say. And it's it's awesome. It's fantastic.
I'm pretty sure she does the truck stop mud flap pose too, where she's based. No,
yeah, it's well, maybe it's quite. Yeah. I don't have it. I am not one of those guys that like collected my Playboys. I would get a bunch of them, and I would take them to, like, you know, wherever you like the, you know, the used like magazine store or whatever.
Goodwill.
Seem like, wrong to throw them away.
Yeah,
you can't. You know, that's just like destroying. You know, that's destroying the Mona Lisa.
Garbage bin everywhere. I'm just like, yes, please do have some.
Yeah, but she was, because she did. She was on Friday, I think, and Godfrey was on Saturday.
Yep.
I think they did the back to back thing there. So excellent. Mm. All right, there you go.
This is all true.
This is all true. Thank you. All right, thanks. I wonder where I was going, but thank you for leading me my true north, sir. We'll take a break back after this with more from the News Desk and Humor Me, Comedy 101. It is Friday. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
In the future, after the big war, there will come a time to rebuild and a need for a new and special kind of soldier.
This man is carrying a loaded weapon.
Prepare to meet the next great American hero.
That's where you come in.
Are you serious?
His name is...
Hell. Sam Hell.
Never heard of you.
We're going to Frogtown.
And this is the adventure he's been waiting for.
We're gonna get him out, and then you're gonna get him pregnant.
And if anyone's got a chance in hell of rescuing the virgins from the evil clutches of Tony...
It's a miracle.
Right.
Be there for the action. The adventure.
Oh, Sam.
What are you doing?
And be there for the dance of the three snakes.
Dance or die.
We're all gonna die.
When hell comes to Frogtown. Starring Rowdy Roddy Piper as Sam.
Get off!
You are one weird dude.
Sandal Bergman as Nurse Spangle.
Wired to blow.
Hell comes to Frogtown.
Eat lead, froggies!
listening to the Emerson News Network. You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I wouldn't steer you wrong on this. Hi there, it's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We were just talking during the break about it. So I don't know if anybody saw this. A few people who saw this last night, and then they were posting comments about it. If you saw this in my Twitter feed last night, you can also find it on my Facebook page. I put it up around 10 o'clock or so. The video for the new song by Red Fang, and I have to thank Ryan White for the Oregonian for cluing us into that, because I'd kind of heard some of their stuff, but I hadn't really, I hadn't heard a lot of it, and I was sort of passingly familiar with them. And he told me, he's like, you really have to hear them. He's like, you will love these guys. They're awesome. And I thought, well, okay, you know, I'll try to get around to doing that one of these days. And he sent me a link to the video, and he just said, here, like, you've got to watch it. Here is the link. You must view this now. And I got to tell you, it's like mind-blowingly great. It is one of the best videos I've seen in a long time, and it's certainly like the best video that I can remember seeing in recent memory. Because I remember the last time a video impressed me. The last time I saw a music video and I went, well, that's really something. I'd like to see that again and tell people to watch it. I mean, I think the last thing I saw that was kind of impressive was that video, one of those OK Go videos where they did the treadmill thing. And then there was the one after that was like
one
the huge mousetrap.
Yeah,
like
the Rube Goldberg
video. Yeah, and it ended with like the thing spray painting like the name of the record or whatever. But there was, I think, two different versions of that video. Yeah, where it was like it followed the whole Rube Goldbergian contraption all through, which was astounding. This... I will just say that the setup for the video is, it opens with the members of the band sitting on their ratty couch, undoubtedly somewhere in Southeast Portland, and they're going through the mail, and it's bills, 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 and at the end, the final thing they see is a check from the record company for $5,000, and the check, and it may in fact be the actual check they got from the record company, I don't know, but it starts with them opening their mail, and there's a check from Relapse Records, and it's for $5,000, and it says, here's the budget for your video, don't blow it. And so then the next 3.5 minutes are, what can they do with $5,000 to make the best music video you've ever seen? How can they? And that's sort of the challenge, is how can they make the best video in the history of the form with only $5,000 and with no real resources? And I have to tell you, I don't know if it's the best video of the last couple of years, but I can't think of anything I've seen that has had a stronger, like, sort of yeah effect on me. And if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. You know exact, because you don't really know what's going on. You don't quite get. And I realize this isn't a thing you'll have to watch, but you don't quite get what's happening, which is why you start to watch the threads all come together. And there comes a moment about 3 minutes in where suddenly it all becomes clear, and you kind of go, yeah, this is going to be awesome. And I actually leaned forward in my chair at home to get closer to the screen to watch it. And it was, in fact, just as glorious as I had anticipated. So
you'll pay for the whole seat, but you'll only need the edge.
I'm just saying, it's you get your money's worth in the first 1 minute. The other 4 minutes are free, as they used to say.
Nice.
So you can see this at you go to twitter.com/RickEmerson or facebook.com/RickEmerson. Click in the video for the new Red Fang. Click in the link for the new Red Fang video. It's quite something. This is all brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com or going to facebook.com/RickEmerson. You can also call them. It's 503-252-1609. That is 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. That means that if you're having some sort of issue, some sort of difficulty, some sort of problem, some sort of a... I don't know. You're having some sort of a you're kvetching about the thing that's gone all meshuggah on you. You can have them come out and they'll take care of it, and they're going to take care of it the first time. They're going to take care of it, correctly, which means you don't have to have somebody else come out and kind of clean up after them. And they're not going to wreck your whole joint while they're out there. They're going to make sure the house looks good when they leave as well. And you're going to get what you pay for, and you're going to make sure that they're going to make sure that you are happy with it, and that you're not having to pay more in the long term by having to get it done 2, 3, 4 times.
So but will they wrestle you?
They might wrestle you. I mean, really, if you put like $5 down, like for an extra, maybe even less than that, maybe for just, as we've learned, the way to Ben's heart is through, is through cobbler. So if you had some sort of a cobbler, a crisp, perhaps a pan of some sort of, some sort of a noodly goodness, they might actually, give you a little extra something. And you know what I mean.
I'd fight a bear for a crisp.
Well, these things are all open to negotiation. It is a capitalist society in which we live, Jim. Squires Electric. Find them at squireselectric.com or facebook.com/Squires Electric. Proud sponsors of this, the Rick Emerson radio program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
All right. The new Red Fang album, by the way, is called Murder the Mountains. That is the name of the album. The name of the single is escaping me at the moment, but apparently, the new record is Murder the Mountains. And it is, it's like, from what I've heard of it, it's like Do you ever listen to a record and you like you hear the single or you hear like the standout track and you go, well, that's great. Now, why can't you just make a whole album of that?
Yeah.
You know, and then it's like you listen to the rest of it and it's all crap and you realize that that single is totally non-representative of their style.
Yeah.
But then eventually you hear a band that has done a whole record of that. And you go, see, this is what you should have done, a whole record of that one song.
Yeah.
Which is what we like the sort of the Sugar Ray technique. What Red Fang apparently has done is they have listened to Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. And they said, let's just make a whole album of that one song. And, you know, which is exactly what a lot of guys have been sitting around waiting for, I think. So really, I cannot recommend it strongly enough. And it goes without saying, the song is exceptional, too. The video is great. The song is also wonderful. And it just... And I mean this in a completely sincere way. I don't mean this in a sort of... This is sort of thing that can easily sound corny. But there are so many... overt and oblique references to Portland and Portland culture in this video that at the end you do get kind of a warm glow of pride inside. When you kind of go, that's right. Represent.
Keeping Portland awesome.
It is Portland. Plus, it was filmed at a lot of locations that they filmed it at. What is that place? Is it on 82nd? I'm assuming it must be, but it's like a grocery outlet store on 82nd that is, I think, near a Value Village. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Because I've gone there to purchase things a time or two in my life, and there's a substantial amount of purchasing of a specific item that's done at this particular place. So, anyway, do watch it when you get the chance. We'll do a human
trafficking?
Jim and I are both confused by this.
I didn't say that. What?
We have no idea what you mean.
A certain thing that... What?
I'm just saying. You'll see. It'll all make sense.
Oh, in the video. There's a certain...
Yeah, there's a certain thing that I buy there.
That's what it sounded like.
After telling the man that I'm here about the Beagles. And then he says, oh, the Beagles. And I say, yes.
He says it's a cool day for pontooning.
Exactly. The cow is in the den. The cow is in the den. Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
The occupant of a home in Bowling Green was awakened early in the evening by a man who had broken into his home and climbed into bed with his mother. The man, whose name was redacted from police records...
Not his own mother. The man hadn't climbed into bed with his own mother.
No, the man had climbed into bed with the resident's
with the complainant's mother.
Yes.
Okay.
He called police. His dog had been barking. Barking dogs had alerted him. He found an unknown, extremely drunk man in bed with his mother. The sleeping bandit was wearing blue jeans, a gray shirt, and a brown hat. He was bloodied and left blood on the back door and on the sheets. The resident's mother escorted the man out of their home while he was claiming several times that he was inside Woody's house. The resident called the police. Officers weren't able to find the man until about 2 hours later when he did the same thing again down the block, walking to someone's house and going to sleep on the couch. This resident exited the home and called the police. Then officers responded to the home and they found him, Benjamin Williams, 37, asleep on the couch inside the home. He matched the description of the guy who had been sleeping in the bed with the other guy's mother.
Mm-hmm.
He was wearing muddy pants that were wet in the front, where he appeared to have urinated on himself.
That'll happen.
He also had black smears on his face and hands. Police determined Williams had eaten the ashes out of a hookah pipe inside the residence. The resident showed police where a window screen had been broken. It also appeared that once Williams came inside the home, he helped himself to several cupcakes, valued at $3, and ransacked the man's refrigerator. They searched him, and they found two hydrocodone pills in his front right pocket, a ceramic pipe with marijuana residue in it. His pockets also contained several disposable razors, a bottle of Drakkar Noir cologne.
Yeah.
Attention, ladies.
A bottle of Adidas cologne, skin cleanser, and two pickled sausages.
Sometimes...
Was he thinking he was in Monty Hall's home?
I will give $500 to anyone who has two pickled sausages in their pocket right now.
And a bottle of Drakkar Noir.
I mean, seriously, that's the combination of things that doesn't make any sense right there.
Maybe he was on a scavenger hunt. Maybe we should get off his back.
Maybe.
Woody is a tricky character.
God damn. Where was this at?
Bowling Green, which is in Maryland, I think.
You don't really think of that as being typical Maryland behavior.
No.
Have you been to Maryland?
No, I mean, yeah,
there's some weird tap water on the East Coast.
Seriously. One of those things that, in a way, disturbs you way more than if it was just a guy burgling the joint.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you know that he's pulling
a Robert Downey and just coming into your house and going to sleep.
Well, and plus, with all of the weird conglomeration of items, like, you know, his brain had a reason for picking each one of those. Like, there was a purpose to each one of those things.
Well, this must be Woody's house. It looks like it.
Because with the aftershave, you know, sometimes you're going out and you're not sure what fragrance you want to go with. Maybe it's a Drakkar night. Maybe it's an Adidas night. You don't know. So you take both just to be sure, and then you let the night decide.
I got to tell you, that Drakkar Noir, that is a cologne that I will always associate. More than Stetson, more than English leather, that is the scent that I associate with high school.
Oh, yeah.
It was like every guy in the world, because that was like if you were too sophisticated for Stetson.
Yeah.
Too sophisticated for your just, you know, like your off-brand Polo or whatever.
Yeah, that you would wear Polo that. And Brut were mine. Yeah. So, yeah.
And because it came in like a matte black bottle, you know, and so therefore,
the weird,
you know,
rhombus-y type shape.
Totally, and it costs slightly more than like your regular bottom shelf Payless cologne, and so you figured like it was for when it was really time to bring the love. You know, that was when you only use that for special occasions, for very special
Rick,
dates.
When you wear your card, the love comes to you.
Well, okay, that's the number of friends of mine who's like their cars would just reek of that because they would keep a bottle like in the glove box. Like, just, like, break in case of, like, hotness. You know, like, if you should happen to, like, you know, be passing by, like, the, you know, like the color guard as they're on their way home from school and they all need a ride. So, all right. Let's do one more here and then we'll...
TMZ's Harvey Levin talks about Arnold Schwarzenegger's love child, who was born about the same time as Schwarzenegger's youngest son with Marie Shriver.
Is this cut four?
Yeah.
He's actually 13 now, and we got the birth certificate, and this boy was born 1 week apart from Marie and Arnold's son, Christopher. So they were indeed pregnant at the same time, birth separated by 1 week.
Christopher Schwarzenegger, by the way, who I believe I read he has changed his name to Christopher Shriver.
Is that true?
Like already.
Well,
yes.
You know, the thing is, I can't imagine what kind of a relationship he and Schwarzenegger have anyway, because he's a doughy little bastard.
Yeah.
He's, you know, and I know that maybe there's just, you know, maybe the pressure of growing up in the Schwarzenegger household is such that, you know, maybe you just think, well, I'm not going to work out. I'm going to have another Pop-Tart.
I take comfort in my snickerdoodles.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. As long if he's happy, I'm happy. But I mean, this is a thing I never thought I'd say. I know from interviewing Catherine Schwarzenegger, that Arnold was very like he was very, very conscious of like, you know, his like what everybody was eating at dinner and like what kind of food was in the house. And he apparently was, you know, like he was that guy. He would go through the cupboards every now and again just to make sure that nothing had been stashed away that he did not approve of. He was sort of like a caloric great Santini, just kind of going through and just deciding that, you know, these pastry strudels, these are not appropriate, and just into the trash they would go. And so you wonder like how that kid got to be that way without, you know, like dad stepping in at some point, unless he was occupied with, you know, spreading his seed elsewhere.
Because swallowing your feelings, there is no nutritional facts for swallowing your feelings of hate and inadequacy.
Yeah. Shame takes up a lot of space.
And then
it does.
You come from a rich family. You have enough pocket money that you can buy many of those tasty tiny donuts at the 7-Eleven.
He probably has like his own little apartment somewhere, and he's just got like a couch made of red vines that he just sort of lays on. And
oh, that's a fair point.
Levin has seen photos of the child, he says. The boy's about 13, and he says from appearances, there's little doubt about who his father is.
I'm telling you, he is just a spitting image of Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, the lips and the teeth are just really a ringer. And, you know, it's funny, now he's got kind of that Conan-type look.
That's almost certainly not true.
He's 13.
What is best in life, having batteries for my DS? Hearing the lamentations of my Facebook enemies as they tried before me.
Psychologist Jeff Gardier doesn't believe that Schwarzenegger's wife, Marie Shriver, will reconcile with her husband after this revelation.
That is the ultimate betrayal, and we're talking about a love child coming out of this. I don't think there's any way she's going to survive it, and she's got a responsibility to other women, and I would believe, especially being that famous, coming from that famous family, to say, you know what, Arnold, we're not going to let you get away with this behavior. I'm out of there.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what she's thinking about right now, is her responsibility to all those other women out there.
She's thinking about you, Dawn. She's concerned about you now.
She wants to make sure that when I find out my husband has been screwing the help, that I'll stand up for myself and make sure that I get $1 billion settlement because she cares about me, the little guy.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, like, the upside of that would mean that you were finally at a place in your life where you had the help.
That's
so
true.
I mean, you know, it's almost worth it.
You know, if I get household help, Pat can screw them all he wants.
I was just going to say, like, would you really take that as a trade-off? Like, if you got maid service, but like he just, you know, got his bonk on every now and again.
If I could have even like, you know, an 18th of the money they have and household help, yeah, Pat can hump it out with them all he wants. I'm fine with that.
Attention House Cleaning Services. The Rick Emerson Radio Program is here to provide advertising opportunities and openings for you.
These services may be yours.
I will say a couple of things. First of all, when you just said what is best in life and you did the lamentations of Facebook, I was trying to put together something like that too, like what is best in life when you're 13? And I realized that all of my references are just so dated because it's like I don't watch what 13-year-olds watch anymore because I was going to make like an Invader Zim joke or something, which is just not going to work. But you know what? The Invader Zim thing triggered in my head. It just as a site, and I'm surprised that none of us said this. You know what else Randy Savage did? He was one of the voices on Dexter's Laboratory.
That's right.
He was the voice. Yeah. He was a wrestler, but I forget his name because it was when he was like wrestling Monkey.
Yeah. And Monkey was the one that saved like the universe.
Yeah. But what was the name of the cartoon? It wasn't just Monkey. It was like an offshoot of the Dexter's Lab thing. There was Dexter's Lab, and then there was Monkey, and then there was...
My girlfriend is screaming at her computer right now because she would know the answer to this.
And there was this whole thing where Monkey had to then, you know, Monkey had to wrestle Macho Man's character, you know, for the fate of the Earth. And I think he said, "Little Monkey, your display of heart has touched me. I will spare your world." Or whatever. I can't do it like you can. But he does, you know, and then everybody holds up signs saying, like, "We love Monkey."
Yeah.
Or whatever. It was awesome. I remember not knowing he was going to be on it, just watching Dexter's Lab when at like 2 a.m. And I came on and I was like, "That's no way. Is this Randy Savage?" And, you know, of course, my friend from Philly was like, "F yeah, it's Randy Savage." And it was just thinking it was awesome. Well,
apparently that was the episode Dial M for Monkey.
Dial M for Monkey.
Yes,
of Dexter's Laboratory.
Yeah, that's right. It was awesome. That was a really, really, I got to say.
And the wrestler's name was Rasslor.
Rasslor, yes.
I am Rasslor.
That's totally what it, I mean, he was, and he was like sort of like a Galactus kind of a, like he was an eater of worlds.
Yeah,
and he was coming, but yeah, he wrestled Monkey for the fate of the Earth.
It was like Van Halen and all the other ones went up against, or Van Whalen, or
something like that. Yeah,
it was all the other heroes attempted to stop him, and they couldn't.
And I think there was Van Whalen, and there was like. There was a wrestler named like Super G or something, and he was like a hip-hop wrestler or whatever. So yeah, I'd forgotten all about that until the Invader Zim thing in my head. So, all right. Well, let's see here. So we can do Comedy 101 or that. We should do the Penis Watch, though.
Okay.
Let's do the Penis Watch, then Comedy 101. And we're all kind of running behind, and also it's a little warm in here.
We're so behind, and it's so warm in here.
All right.
Okay,
Penis Here's
watch.
Your Penis Watch for Friday.
Take a look at
Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Penis. My troubles start a melting away.
Bow, bow,
I take
bow,
a look at my enormous penis. And everything is going my way.
Bow, here's your penis watch for Friday.
I'm trying to figure out where the town of Coralville is, real quick. So let's see if we find this out. Coralville. Thank you. And thank you, autocorrect.
Loading.
Let's change that to Coralville.
Try to spell anal.
Well, not right this time.
I believe your listenership is very important to us. We'll be with you in just a moment.
I believe it's in Iowa. Let's say Iowa. Police said a woman bit her boyfriend's penis during an argument earlier this month.
Oh.
According to Coralville police, officers responded after a 911 call came from the residence.
How could her side of the argument even be understood?
Police said 32-year-old Lucina V. Kinder and her live-in boyfriend got in an argument that escalated when Kinder punched her boyfriend, who is not identified, in the face, scratched his shoulder, and then bit his penis, causing it to bleed. The two have been living together for more than a year. Kinder was arrested this week and charged with domestic assault without intent to cause injury, a serious misdemeanor.
Intent to cause injury? Biting, by definition, is meant to cause injury or at least pain.
Well, she hit him and she bit his penis. I would believe that.
Were they fighting nude, does it say? I mean, I'm trying to figure out exactly how.
Well, she might have bitten him through his pants, maybe, but I'm sure they were fighting. Here's the thing is her photo, you can see it on here. There is a mugshot. Lucinda here looks like she would do it again. She just looks like she would.
Oh, that's a penis
she
biter.
Got crazy eyes.
She would bite your penis in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. No, she would bite the hell out of your penis.
Yeah.
Your penis has never been bitten like Lucinda will bite it.
She's thinking about it right now. She's like, I will bite your penis.
Jesus.
Don't think.
Seriously, like the camera guy right now knows it. He's covering up.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Could you smile for me? Could you? No. Oh, that's fine.
She's got a serious jaw too. I mean, that's like we're talking hundreds of pounds per square inch right there in terms of pure pressure.
Her jaw was built for penis biting.
This jaw was built for maiming.
And that's just what it'll do.
No. That's
one
where you
these
just
days this jaw is gonna bite
all over
into.
You. All right, Joel.
You just let her watch whatever she wants to watch on TV that night. You don't need to. You can catch
maybe
it later.
Maybe you buy her own TV. How about them?
Exactly.
Them apples.
All right, there you go. There's your penis watch for.
Take a look at my enormous penis, and my troubles start a melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
Since we're doing running so late today anyway, can I read the Cannibal Watch real quick?
Oh, just sure,
close,
why not?
Close out the week.
So we can start next week with a clean slate. Here's your Cannibal Watch for Friday. Here's your Cannibal Watch for Friday.
A man suspected to be behind the appearance of dismembered body parts across Moscow in recent weeks was arrested early Tuesday morning after half-eaten human innards were found in his home. The police found a stew made from a human liver in the fridge at the suspect's apartment in East Moscow. They believe the liver to be part of the same body as various dismembered body parts found scattered around Moscow in recent weeks. The decapitated head of a middle-aged man was found in the Moskva River in the west of the city on Wednesday. An arm severed at the wrist was pulled from the water under a bridge in South Moscow's Tsaritsino Park on May 2nd, and 2 feet were discovered floating nearby in the Moskva River on the same day. A hand and another arm were later discovered in the same area. Police believe the suspect killed his friend and tried to destroy the evidence by severing the body parts and hiding them around the city. Detectives established the identity of the dead body by taking fingerprints. After that, police tracked down the suspected offender through a circle of the deceased friends. The suspect, whose identity is not disclosed, has a history of mental illness.
No!
Oh, get out.
No, get... No. So no.
This is in Moscow?
It's in Moscow.
All right. I mean, is it? You know, this is one of those things where... You know, wherever you are in the world, whatever city you live in, it seems like you could always, you know, things could always be worse. And you say, well, at least I'm not whatever. Moscow seems like one of those places.
Well, I also, this guy, he killed his friend for whatever reason he killed him, decided to cut him up and scatter the body parts around the city to dispose of them, as you do. But apparently at some point he was cutting the guy up and just went, ooh, liver. I like liver. And decided that part he'd keep.
Well, he's got to keep strength up. I mean, you know, you got a lot of
hiding the body takes iron out of you.
Yeah, a lot too.
All right, there's your Cannibal Watch for there you go, for Friday. Does it seem like this show in itself is just a
distasteful, unpleasant?
Why was it going to? We are sort of a
collapse like a flan in a cupboard.
I was just gonna say that we are sort of a microcosm of the. Of societal ill on this show.
Yeah, I'd say.
I mean, when you consider that, you know, like 20% of our stories are penis biting and the other 20% are cannibals, and then there's, you know, 20% of just dudes lighting a thing on fire, you know, and then kicking it down a hill. So, I mean, it just... Yeah, all right. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Do you guys need to step out, or do you need to? Or should we do the Comedy 101?
Let's just soldier through and do it. Let's go.
All right, let me get ready to prepare this. By the way, before we do that, Big Jim Willig is here, of course, to do Humory Comedy 101. As I prepare this, you've got a gig coming up, a show, a performance.
That is correct.
Please tell.
This Tuesday, the 24th, we'll be at the Mudai Lounge, which is 804. I believe.
It is at 801 Northeast Broadway.
Excuse me, 801, thank you. 801 Northeast Broadway, hosted by the one and only Timmy Williams from The Whitest Kids You Know. It'll also feature Richie Stratton, Sean Fleek, as well as one or two other surprise comics, as well as myself. So please come on out and check us out. It'll be the Ride the Light show this Tuesday, the 24th, at the Moodai Lounge, starting at 9 p.m.
I meant to ask you, how did the Applebee's gig go? Did the crowd, did they dig you?
like I said, I took the bullets. I went first, or the JFK spot, as I call
clean.
It. And played it very clean. Got some responses, but very much you feel like you're because you're not in a comedy club. I felt like I was just making a scene in a restaurant. Because like, there are some people that are responding, there are others that are just like just finish your salad, Gladys, and we'll just get out of here, and then we'll go to like the you know the dress barn, and we'll get you a nice outfit.
Like you were just like, you felt like you were just the guy who was bothering the other patrons after one too many Mai Tais.
Yeah. So, but unfortunately, that responsibility fell on somebody else's hands. But I got up there. I did some like brand new squeaky clean material that I got a fairly positive response from. So I got paid. I got a free meal. I call it a win. So
awesome.
Thank you, Applebee's.
Excellent. It's time for another exciting installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please give your attention to Mr. Big Jim Willick?
Thank you very much, Mr. Emerson. It was Nietzsche that first said that God is dead. It was John Lennon who said that Paul is dead. And it was, of course, Eric Idle who once said,
"Bring out your dead!"
Clip gets me every time. It's got to be the dog howling in the background. That life is a study of death, and comedy is a study of life. Ergo, comedy is death. Everything about it sounds so brutal. If you did well, then you killed. If you sucked out loud, then you died. And there's nothing new under the sun. If these words sound familiar, then you're not only a child of comedy, but also of philosophy as well. And one of philosophy's favorite sons is, of course, Mr. Steve Martin.
I was born a poor black child.
That's right. Steve is originally from Waco, Texas, the quiet town of Waco, Texas.
We'll be starting in just a few moments, just waiting for the drugs to take effect.
Story of Mr. Martin is pretty well known. His comedy career took off like an arrow pointed straight to the temple of success. Soon, his presence was on par with that of rock stars, and this change caused Steve to want to shift gears to acting. But the fans took it in stride. After all, you know, it was still the same old Steve.
Okay, I need revenge against all my enemies. They should die like pigs in hell.
Taking a blind leap from one medium to another at the zenith of your career is terrifying, to say the least. But Steve's philosophy has always been, the greatest thing you can ever do is surprise yourself. And besides, what's there to be frightened of when God's dead? And with that, I turn the spotlight on my other two amigos, Mr. Rick Nevin P. Johnson Emerson and Don Frerling Clawhammer Taylor. Your thoughts on Mr. Steve Martin?
Well, Don will have more of these than I do, so you should start.
I'm not sure if I really do, but I will say that I have always loved Steve Martin, and part of the reason is because, like a lot of comedians, he to a certain extent plays the buffoon.
Yeah.
His character as a stand-up performer was that of a guy with a huge ego who thought he was so much funnier and so much more talented than he actually was. And yet that in and of itself made what he was doing all the funnier.
Yeah.
Also, just, I've not too long ago read his book, Born Standing Up, and actually, which he it is all just about his journey, his career arc of how he started acting, how he wanted to get into comedy, starting as a kid working at Disneyland when he was something like 9 or 10 years old,
yeah.
selling park maps for 10 cents a piece, you know, at the front of the park. Then he would got to wander around the park all day, and then he started hanging out at the Magic Shop and at the Wild West Review, where he watched the old like vaudeville style comedian on stage there, and realized that those were two things he really wanted to do, was comedy and magic, and got to learn how to do both basically by working part-time at Disneyland all the way up into his teens.
Yeah.
And eventually decided not to, that he needed to go to college because that's what you do. And he studied philosophy. And the more he studied philosophy, the more it got him thinking about the way he handled stand-up. And that he wanted there to be this sort of, you know, bizarre kind of surreal disconnect in the things he said. And philosophy really, really influenced his stand-up. So the thing is, he's someone who, oh, for a great deal of his career, both his original stand-up act, movies like The Jerk, the Man with Two Brains,
yes.
Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, playing guys that were dim and not terribly smart,
yeah.
When in fact he is a brilliant, brilliant man, a fine art connoisseur, a guy who studied philosophy, a guy who has written plays. And so, like all of the best people who play stupid, the fact is it's based on a foundation of someone who is just searingly intelligent.
Absolutely. You know, his banjo playing seems kind of like, oh, well, that's kind of a funny novelty, but like a legitimately respected musician on the instruments, to the point where other artists, both in country and contemporary music as well, all just sort of would love to sort of have him. And he has done several projects to the point where he's gotten Grammys for both comedy and music, which in and of itself is a fair accomplishment for one's right. When I was researching him, I was looking at like the flashpoint of his career where he was performing originally in clubs, and then it got to larger and larger venues. To the point where he was doing these gigantic stadium shows. And for comedy, it is so difficult, very off-putting for the performer themselves, unless you actually have somebody else to kind of help anchor you with the performance. When you're up there in front of like thousands of people, it's so very disconnecting, because the more the audience is there, you feel like the less of a connection you have with them. You need there to be like kind of like a cutoff point. Mm-hmm. For the people that are in front of you with them.
And that's what he said in the book, too, is that because it did happen very quickly. It all happened over the course of just a few years that he went from playing, you know, small clubs in like the East Village. Well, in like the L.A. area, he played like folk music clubs and did that, would play his banjo, do his comedy, was refining his act, moved up into places that had a couple hundred people, went, I'm successful, moved up to places that had a few thousand people. And then the album came out, which was sort of unusual because he wasn't actually all that famous when they released the album, which is unheard of, releasing a live comedy album of someone who isn't really hugely famous. And yet that made him hugely famous, that and his appearances on Saturday Night Live. And the next thing was he was all of a sudden he was playing, you know, the Hollywood Bowl. He was playing in front of 10,000 people and realized that now the art wasn't the art anymore, because you can't actually have a relationship with your audience that way. The laughter after a joke, there would be like there would
a
be
wave.
Like and there would be like a second or two before the sound would actually make it to him. The thing also, people had heard the jokes on the albums and seen them on TV, they would start laughing before he'd even finished getting the joke out too. So it completely ruined the entire art for him. And about the same time, he started making movies and went, wait a minute, you mean I could make a whole lot of money and actually hang out with people and have lunch with someone and have friends rather than spending all of my time in hotel rooms and feeling bad because my art is... I'm making movies.
Yeah. No, I mean, and the Muppet Show and Muppet Movies, basically, when they were also at their zenith, the popular misconception that he was actually a member of SNL, when in fact he was just like the guest. He still holds the record, I believe, for like 25 appearances, and is the only person to have done a season premiere, a Christmas special, and the season finale all in 1 year. You know, he's basically, he is it when it comes. That's where the mentality is that, oh, I guess I always thought that he was part of the cast. Well, no, he's just, he has that universal adapter that he can kind of get plugged into an environment like that and seem just as at home with them as he is on stage by himself.
If you want to see something that is both hilarious and awkward, though, I believe you can find this on YouTube. When he was a young comedian and doing early stand-up acts, you know, he did the circuit, he did the talk shows, he did the sketch comedy shows, he did the Carol Burnett Show, and you can find it on YouTube. There was a sketch that he was in a sketch, and they were just, it was like the plug this comedian guy into, and so he walked in playing ostensibly a character in the sketch, but he had to say, because I'm a wild and crazy guy, because, you know, he was that guy.
Yeah.
And the audience applaud. But it's very awkward. It's very awkward and very uncomfortable to watch him being sort of put in that position. But, you know, that's the career.
Yeah. So, with all that kind of implied. And then he makes the jump to acting, which, you know, some comedies. And then he kind of like parlayed more into like a more serious role. And then started writing his plays as well, which at first were kind of like a little, critically reviewed. Because it was like one of these things where like, he can't be this good at everything. We have to kind of find fault with something at some point. Otherwise, we just give him like a clear pass. For
and also, and like, also, there's that whole thing of like, oh, look at the comedian trying to act like he's all smart and everything.
That's and that's when I said that I didn't have that Don would probably have said more to say about Steve Martin than I do. I am not tremendously familiar with his stand-up because that was not even before my time. It was a kind of. I was never exposed to his stand-up when I was younger, when I was a teenager or whatever, because, I mean, it certainly existed, it was out there, but I had no one, it wasn't like anything my dad was going to listen to. You know, my dad listened to, you know, Bill Cosby, and my dad, you know, listened to, you know, like we had Alan Sherman and Stan Freeberg, and, you know, and I had, you know, Dr. Demento, who played Tom Lehrer and stuff like that, but there was nobody in my family who was into his comedy, And I just, you know, and I just grew up in I guess maybe the circle of acquaintances or in a culture or whatever, which is the kind of weird, angular, cerebral sort of stand-up. It just wasn't a thing I was exposed to.
Yeah.
So I didn't hear that in my formative years. And but then when you broaden out to look at, so I can't really speak to that, but when you look at the rest of his career, I mean, the thing that makes it so hard to talk about Steve Martin is the fact that he is so brilliant that he can't just be boiled down to one or two things. And some of the guys that we do boil down to one or two things, like Rodney Dangerfield or Sam Kinison, they're much more layered than that, but at least they've got a hook.
Yeah.
They've got the thing you can, they've got a focal point you can fixate on. With Steve Martin, it's like, you know, you've got his stand-up, and then you've got Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, which is, those two things are fundamentally different. Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, I mean, in terms of the plot, in terms of the way they're executed, is different from Man with Two Brains.
Well, he also wrote Roxanne,
right,
and L.A.
Yeah.
Story.
I was going to say, L.A. Story is not like anything he's ever done. And then he's also the same guy that did Three Amigos.
Yeah.
And he's also, you know, he's also the same guy that did, he did dramatic roles. I remember seeing him for the first time. The first time I saw him do drama, he was in the television, the HBO adaptation of The Band Played On, which is Randy Schilt's book about the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he played the brother of a closeted gay man who was reluctant to admit to his brother's gay lifestyle. And it was... that's the great and weird thing about Steve Martin, is that it's hard to talk about him because there is... He's such a moving target. There is no one thing he does. And he, you know, and he wrote, was it Shop Girl? Was that the name of the... And then he's now done several other books. And he's, as you said, he's done a lot of, you know, compositions and recordings musically, some of which are funny, some of which are not. And it's just... He really is great, but in a way that almost makes it hard to talk about him because he is so multifaceted and so textured. But he does seem at all times to be a guy who follows his own barometer.
Yeah.
He follows his own compass, whether or not it seems commercially viable or whether or not it's what people think he ought to be doing. Somebody's mentioning you know, that he's fantastic in Parenthood. He's legitimately mm-hmm. funny, legitimately sweet, which is true. And it's like that's, again, a thing that he seems to be able to pull that out. Like, without any effort at all. Like, when he needs to make a movie that is fun, that is legitimately charming and touching, that he's able to do it without any strain. And yet it obviously, he clearly is a guy whose brain is so hyper-developed and who is so massively intelligent that it is foolish of us to expect him to be able to be, you know, to be one thing, to be the guy with the arrow through his head forever, to be the guy making the jerk forever, to be the guy just writing plays forever. I mean, he obviously is just too smart for that and too impatient for that.
Well, I wonder sometimes if he's just one of those guys, too, that he has to constantly be doing something. Because that explains, you know, why he makes banjo albums and why he writes books. And also, that would help explain why he takes roles in movies that just, frankly, sometimes aren't very good.
Yeah.
You know, doing something like, you know, The Out-of-Towners or
the Pink Panther remix.
Bringing down the house with Queen Latifah, which was just dreadful. You know, and I guess it's just sort of like, I got to work. I got some free time. I need to keep doing something, I guess.
Well, and it's one of those things where, you know, like you said, your brain is so hyper-keyed that you have to constantly be doing something. Maybe that's how you kind of deal with the madness to keep from, like, cracking up, is that you constantly throw something else in the mix to, like, you know, either I have to learn it or I have to sort of continue on with this project until it's done. And then that kind of keeps the storm of monkeys that are inside your head constantly, you know, wanting to be fed.
That is possible with him because he admits in the Born Standing Up book, that he suffers from an anxiety disorder. He used to suffer from just debilitating panic attacks.
So,
and it took a long time for him to figure out what they even were because, you know, he never went to see anybody about it for a long time. He just choked it down and just, you know, muddled through it without ever talking to anybody.
Yeah. So, yeah, all those things about Steve really kind of, you know, basically being a genius or having that level of intelligence going all the time, it's kind of like and playing the buffoon and doing it so convincingly. It's kind of like Christina Applegate, who is like most famously known for playing Kelly Bundy, complete airhead, slut, ditz. But at the same time, she's a member of Mensa. She's incredibly intelligent. So that's kind of like the you know, the proof in a way is like you're so smart that the only way to really kind of be on the target or be on the radar and have people understand you is by playing somebody that's such an idiot so convincingly that people assume that that's how
that
you are
you.
In real life.
Yeah. I will say, by the way, that I was just gonna go back to a point we'd already made, but it is. One of those things where you stop back and you look at the body of work that Steve Martin has created, and you realize in a strange way you get a sense of like how lucky we are to sort of be here right now with, you know, there aren't a lot of guys like Steve Martin around, and there aren't a lot of guys who have enough mainstream success that you are aware of them and that you are here able to see them as they're, you know, that you can see him as his career unfolds, that you got to see him, you know, in his early SNL days and in the, you know, when he was doing his comedy at the Forum days, all the way through his first forays into film and then into music and into theater and into whatever. And it really is, it's good that you have guys like that around because he does, you know, he's not unlike, you know, his opposite number of like a Dane Cook or somebody. He's a guy who helps set the benchmark. You know, he helps you. It's like resetting. It's like they would say occasionally you should drain your laptop battery all the way down to zero and then charge it again so you always have a true measure of where, you know, so it learns to accurately judge itself. And so the indicator is has a relative sense, so it knows, you know, so it's giving you the correct reading. You need to have a guy who is really, really basic and stupid, and you need to have your Larry the Cable Guy. You need to have a guy like Steve Martin who is showing you exactly how far you can take it and how many medium across, you know, across how many media you can do it, so you get a sense of what is possible for artists. So another installment of Humor Media Comedy 101 today, Mr. Steve Martin. And I will end everything by just reading this statement. A guy says, "The sun is out. I have half a day off. I am nursing my wounds. I am drinking a pound of Rainier beer." I don't know if that's like an actual pound or if he's pounding his Rainier beer. And he says, "I'm listening to the Rick Emerson Show talk about Steve Martin. It is the best day ever." So there you go. That is Big Jim Willig. Find out more about him at BigJimWillig.com. And you can also see him at the Mood Eye Lounge. That is 801 Northeast Broadway this coming Tuesday, the 24th, around 8 p.m.
That's right. Come on out. Timmy Williams, me, Sean Fleek, Richie Stratton, a whole lot of hilarity, please. Come
so
on,
that is, and you can find out more about all of that at BigJimWillig.com. Don't forget, if you missed Hamfisted Radio with Don Taylor, you can hear that at HamfistedRadio.com and live each and every Wednesday at 4 p.m. at Cascadia.fm. After a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore of the day's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. Don't forget to catch Outlook Portland this coming Sunday morning, 6:30, Cable Channel 3, Northwest 32 TV. We're going to be talking to Kyle Yount and Matt Hunter of Kaiju Cast and A Jumps B Shoot, respectively, about life as a podcasting entity in Portland. So that is coming up this coming Sunday, 6:30 on Outlook Portland. You can also find it at OutlookPortland.com. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kunikoa. As always, we thank you for listening. Be safe. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you Monday. It is Friday, May 20th, 2011, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, thanks for listening. Be safe. Bye now.